Interview with Tom Bourbonnier, 824 Manhattan, track 1.
You were 17 years old?
When I joined the service.
You were used to going to school?
Well, I went up to grade 9. You see, like you said, I would have kept on going to school, but my dad, we had our business, and my dad was sick, you know, he had a heart attack. And I had to miss quite a bit of school that year. And, you know, then I started driving, and, you know, I was a kid, trucks and... So I got behind in school, and I'd always, you know, I'd go back, but I wasn't interested anymore because, you know, you get so far back behind, you had the children, you know, and could never catch up. So one day I said to my dad, I said, well, there's no use, you know, I said, I can't get nowhere because you used to make me miss school about maybe 2 weeks a month. So what can you do, you know? Anyway, and I also joined, I used to like skating or hockey, and that play with, I was quite good at it, you know, like my two boys are also here, they played up to junior. So my mother gave my skates away, so I got mad and joined the service. So she got me out, I was underage, so I went right back in again. So then she left me in there anyway, I had a brother, the oldest one. When he found out I was back in there, he decided to join because I was in there. Mm-hmm. He joined the same regiment.
So this was the Grenadiers?
Yes. Mm-hmm. So the poor guy, he ended up in Hong Kong like I did. He went to Jamaica first and all that.
What, did you do training here before you went to
Jamaica? Yes. I mean, I joined in 1939, you see. And I was training at Minto Army. Like, they had all these different regiments. Like, they had the Camerons and Fort Garry Horse. We used to train behind that RCMP barracks.
Oh,
Minto?
Yeah.
No? We trained there for quite a while. And when they checked on the boys, you know, the ages, and they found all kinds of us was underage. So they put us in a little company of our own, you know, in Fort Arthur. And they, you know, trained us by ourselves. And they got Sergeant Major Quinn up the pass. Because we're having a lot of problems, the young fellas, you know. Like, you know, they're stubborn. And, but he was very strict. And he took over, and I'm telling you, he's strict, every one of us. So. Well, it's a good, you know, he did, but we kind of appreciate him after a while. Because he was so military, he was the First World War and all that, you know. He was British and strict. You couldn't believe. He'd just pick up a rifle if you were not, like, he'd be in front of the parade, you know. If you didn't have your eyes always fixed on him, he'd throw the rifle with a bayonet at you. One fellow got it, he cut his hand. Or you got on your toes, you had to be.
What kind of training did you do? Like, what did it consist of?
With him, you mean?
Yeah.
Well.
Or just the training.
General training, like marching and sloping arms and presenting arms and all that, you know. And after a while, they put me down to Main Street, 194, to headquarters. They put a few of us there underage, like, for serve the mess and batting for officers. I was batting for 3 officers and serving the mess. And also, like, the dining room. I enjoyed it there. And Major Hansel, that turned out to be in charge of the MB-10. You might have heard of him.
MB-10,
yeah. Major Hansel, that full control of the MB-10.
Well, what was the
MB-10? Well, MB-10, that's around, all around here, I guess. You know,
oh, I see. Okay.
He was in charge of, they called a certain section, like, you know, you would call Elmwood, you know.
Yeah.
He was in charge of quite a district, you know. That was, he was in charge of everything, like different regiments. He got to be so high, you know. Anyway, he was in charge of us at 194 Main Street, and he got me in there. In his office one morning, he got the Sergeant Major Bain to parade me inside there. That's before I turned in 8. So he said, how would you like to go to officer's training school? I said, I thought it was smart, you know. I said, no, I don't want to be a stooge. So he was really military, you know. He fought in Vimmeridge in the First World War. So he said, that's not very nice. Well, I said, I joined the army to fight, you know. He said, what do you think we did? Well, I said, I don't care. I said, I don't think an officer. I figure he's a stooge, you know. So he gave me about I think it was 20 days, something like that, scrubbing the floors in a mess. And he told the sergeant major, he said, whenever he decides, he make up his mind, you know, bring him back in so many days and see what kind of answer we get from him. All those old blisters. So anyway, he freed me back in there after my sentence was gone. You know? I went in front of him again. So that's a major answer. I still don't want to be a stooge. He said, that's fine. Go back to your regiment. I figure I said stupid or something. I didn't care. So I joined the regiment, and then I went to Bermuda. And in Bermuda, they had picked out 69 men with his guard of honor to the Duke of Windsor. Mm-hmm. And I was on that, like all the same height and all that, you know. I enjoyed Bermuda. I was there 3 months, and we trained only from about 4 o'clock in the afternoon till about 6, you know. All day.
Would this be every day that you would?
Yes, every day, but... all we did at holiday is so warm, you know. All we did is swim in the ocean.
Yeah, I understand that most of the men had a pretty good time when they were connected.
Yeah, well, Bermuda was the best for us, you know. And when we had the Duke of Windsor there, we had this guard of honor. And on the parade, you know, like on the salute, we had these big putties, you know, and short tropical uniform. And my putty come on the... You know, we're on the march path in front of the Duke of Windsor and his wife. And when my putty come undone, the fellow behind me starts stepping on it. He's breaking in pieces, and every time he steps on it, I go forward. And so I managed to jump over the wall, jump out of the parade, you know, over the wall, and roll, and the camera never got me. You know, it would have spoiled the parade, like it would have come to the point, like the big part of the putty would have come loose, and...
This was filmed.
Oh, yes, yeah.
Do you remember who was doing the filming?
No, I couldn't tell. Somebody from Bermuda itself, you know. Mm-hmm. I couldn't tell. You know, I never heard because...
The reason I asked them, I'm interested in any films that the Winnipeg Grenadiers before and after and even during.
I wonder, do you heard of Major Hook? It was an officer in the Winnipeg Grenadiers. No, he wasn't in Hong Kong. No, he was in Jamaica, but he didn't come from Hong Kong. He died, you know, in Hong Kong. Like, I'm trying to figure who it is. Somebody in the regiment took pictures of it also, pretty positive. I'll tell you, tell you something about it. Colonel Triss, who was a major then, was in charge of us in Hong Kong. I don't know if you ever heard his name.
Colonel
Triss. Like it was kind of different, you know. There was no cars, all bicycles. And what I liked about Bermuda, it was higher class people, like, you know, like mostly all retired people. They're white and the colored. They were very independent. They'd say hello to each other, but they never mix. You know what I mean? They had their own clubs. The white had their own clubs, and the colored people had their own clubs. And it was, and yet there was no. No tension whatsoever with the people. Like I say, they mind their own business. Yeah. And the white people, they never interfere with the colored. And they seem to respect each other that way, you know? There was never no... You could never see fights, like, mixing up. You know? Yeah. That's what I like about Bermuda. And the people are very nice to us. They used to come around, especially on Sunday, and invite us, you know, to the afternoon teas and all that, you know. Like they have beautiful ones. And, well, it was kind of quiet for us, you know. What I mean is, to them they were doing a real big thing, but to us, we went there. But after we were there about half an hour, we had that little lunch and everything else, we wanted to go away, get out of there. And Canadian Club was the same, I mean. They opened a Canadian club for us there. They had lots of nice dances for us. But it was all chaperones, you know. They were, like, you know, we lived differently then. Like, for example, if we had a daughter here, and say a young fella come to take our daughter out, well, the mother would go as a chaperone, you know. Well, nobody liked that, right?
Yeah,
we didn't like it. But like, I enjoyed the, I used to like dancing. And I enjoyed the Canadian Club for that. I could go dancing. It didn't cost anything, you know. So I got money signed over to my mother. And a few pounds a week you'd get there, and you didn't go very far. Now, the Lenten Hotel was about maybe 3-4 miles up in the hill. And to go, just to go inside the place to dance, you know, would cost you about 15 shillings.
Well,
and the carriage.
The Grenadiers were mostly garrison troops, trainees garrison troops, is that right?
We were trained as a suicide squad first, like machine gunners. But then we got transferred to infantry as garrison troops.
Garrison troops.
Well, infantry, it's a fighting regiment. They call infantry like it's a marching troop, like in the field, you know.
Mm-hmm.
At first, we were machine gunners. Like, in the, as a machine gunner, they, you set up nests, you know, you don't walk around. You see, you got the Vickers.
Was this the training you received in Winnipeg before you went?
Yes, at the Vickers.
Yeah.
The first 500 men we had were fully trained on Vickers. Vickers machine gunners, that's what we were. We call that suicide squad. Well, as far as I know, suicide squad, you're not supposed to come back, you know. Very few, when you call suicide squad, just like in the war, the kamikazes.
Yeah.
Well, the same thing, them fellas learned how to take a plane off the ground and just dive into a ship. They didn't even know how to land that plane.
Yeah.
Well, they were very effective in the war. Well, they nearly won the war with that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And,
it was the same type of training.
Yes. But then, when we got, when we come back from Jamaica, they put us to they put us in infantry before that. We were in Jamaica, and then they turned us to infantry. Then we start taking the infantry training, like the field fighting and all that, you know, like, it's a different type of fighting altogether. And also, after we got going to Hong Kong, they start showing us this guerrilla fighting. But we have lots of reinforcement. We got two buses of reinforcement in Jamaica to guard prisoners, and a lot of them weren't trained. They weren't trained. And some we picked up right here at South Saskatchewan, you know, regiment here,
mm-hmm.
some of them boys, quite a few of other regiments.
The people that joined in Jamaica, were they trained here in Winnipeg too? Were they Manitoba people?
Yeah, they were sent over there as reinforcement. We were short of men. We were guarding prisoners, you know, like internment camp.
Mm-hmm. Were these German prisoners?
German and Italian.
Mm-hmm.
And they come over there, and we didn't have much time for training because there's so many different duties. Like also, we used to go into the harbor, pick up ships. Like all the ships that come in, we had a ship's detail, three different ship's detail every day, 24 hours a day. Like if number one ship's detail was out taking a ship, and number two would go out. It'd go all night like that. And every day it was different crews, you know? And three ship's detail every day. If one was out, number two went out. If one was back, number two stayed in, number one went out again. And number three was just standing by, you see. Sometimes the three of them were out, bringing ships in all the time, you know. And the next day, how we could get there is about a 12 o'clock pass, maybe a couple times a week, because we had no time, you know. And then you'd go on guard, well, that was for 24 hours. And you'd have, I think it was 2 hours on. And three off or something like that, you know, you go back and forth, you know, different months. Well, they had about 69 men on that guard every night, you know, three different shifts, you see. And we also had some of the prisoners that go in the hospital, and we had to guard them in the hospital. Then every time, say they had three or four in the hospital, well, it'd take maybe four or five guards.
Mm-hmm.
See, you change shift, you know, one has to rest for a few hours and go back on, you see. We had no time whatsoever. Tell you the truth, Jamaica, there was nothing for us. I mean, just work.
Right.
And that's why they brought in reinforcement and officers and also men. I forget how many men they brought the first time. And then after we left there, we come back here. We were here 3 weeks. And a lot of the boys were sick from malaria and everything, you know.
From
old Jamaica.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, it was bad. And it's a very bad island also, you know, very dirty, like the people,
yeah.
It's terrible, like disease and everything else, you know, hospitals sold at all times, like,
were these social diseases?
Yeah, very terrible, oh, it's crazy, terrible place, you know, Well, I think they live like animals there. Well, it's a tropical country, and like the women are fully mature, about 10 years old.
Yeah.
You know, and they're all developed at that age. They're just beggars and tramps, that's all they are. Well, one place is a bar, and the next place is a cat house, you know. It's all, honest. You were you ever there?
No.
Man, for a man to go there, it's terrible. You know, it sounds like, thanks, it sounds like a lot of men say, oh, I like to live there, you know.
Yeah.
You get set up with that pretty fast, you know. And we were the first Canadians there also. They made a Canadian club for us there. There were some white people in Jamaica, but most of the white people over there, they were very independent because they were mostly all, you know, really rich people.
Yeah.
And they didn't mix with us very much, the Canadian club.
Yeah.
Some come around, but there's nothing we can say that we really enjoy. Well, Bermuda was nice, but not Jamaica, not for people to treat us.
Yeah. Do you remember if you did any machine gun training at all when you were down there?
In Jamaica?
Yeah.
No.
And how about the volunteers that you wanted? Did they do any training like that, machine gun training? Or do you remember if they were really incompetent, really well trained?
The ones that we got reinforcement? No. Well, that's one thing we did. We had Newcastle. You might have heard about that.
Yes.
Newcastle in Jamaica. It's a mountain way up, in, you know, way up in the sky. They sent us out a month, a company for a full month. But every 6 months we'd hit there, and you stay there for a month. And what you did there is combat training, like the mask, you know, and how to disarm a fella and all that stuff, you know, like the armed combat.
Was it pretty good training?
Oh yes, very strict training, and we'd run about 6 miles every day. We'd run 3 miles up the mountain before breakfast and 3 miles down, and PT and then your breakfast. You go for a shower and have your breakfast. And all morning was all like, it was arm training, you know, like disarming and everything, arm combat. Which was real good. I mean, like I say, the first 500, well, a lot of people, they talk and they say, well, the grenadiers weren't trained. Well, they're fairly mistaken.
Yeah.
If they would have stayed to the machine gunners, every man we had 500 men on a Vickers machine gun qualified blindfolded. And there's about 82 parts in the mag, in the lock alone in the machine gun, you know. And so many minutes, take it apart, put it back together, blindfolded. Well, you have to know what you're doing.
Yeah.
You know, these all small parts.
Yeah.
And a lot of people, they talk, but it's all talk. Because I'm ready to swear, any man, the first 500, any man we had, they couldn't have been better trained as far as I'm concerned. You know, they knew everything about everything.
Mm-hmm.
Like armed combat and how to disarm anybody, like take a rifle away from a guy or a pistol. We knew how to do that.
The officers were good men too?
Oh, yes. Well, there's the odd one, like in anything else, like some of the soldiers weren't very good either. Eh?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you take for yourself, average officer, they mostly come out of university. You know what I mean? They weren't stupid.
Yeah.
So, if they weren't good, well, some didn't have much training. You know yourself, they come out of university and they got a commission, eh? Well, but the training they did take, they learned, like, maneuvers and all that. Well, you can't please everybody.
Yeah.
As an officer, I don't care who you are, no matter how good you are, there's bound to be somebody to hate you.
Yeah.
And you know yourself, like we had a lot of young men, and a man about 40 years old, 45 years old as an officer, you got to order you around, eh?
Right.
Even my own children. If I'd ask them to be honest with me, I bet you lots of days they hated me, and they're my own children, so imagine what it's going to be like as an officer.
Yeah.
It's the same on anything else, just like I'm doing right now. I train drivers. They go behind my back, they talk about me, I know it. And I figure if they talk about me, they must be learning something.
Right.
You know, it's the same thing in the Army. Like sergeants, corporals. I'll tell you, the best sergeants that we had, they were all Princess Pats in the militia before the war, and some were in the First World War. Most of our sergeants and sergeant majors, like I'll just about say, we had about the best as far as sergeants and sergeant majors. They were all First World War and, you know, man and age.
Yeah,
and they learned, they learned from the field. They were in action.
Mm-hmm.
And the militia sergeants we had, they were good. They were past. Princess Patricia, they were trained, you know. All them fellas, like corporals, you couldn't get a promotion in the Grenadiers, to tell you the truth. Because all the promotions, they were brought in when it started. They were joined and they got their commission right away because they were fully trained men and were just recruits. See? So where could you go? Unless somebody got killed in action, they got his place, that's all.
Were there many young men? You were quite young.
Oh, yes. There was quite a few young fellas. I'd say more than two-thirds was young. But all the top sergeants, not the corporal and lance corporals too much, they were young fellas, some of them. But most of the sergeants and sergeant major and everything was all from the First World War.
Yeah.
They were all trained men. They were, most of them were British. Well, I could name you all kinds of them. They were all British sergeant majors. And the RSM of the regiment was the British also. Well, I think it was about three wars.
Mm-hmm.
RSM Keenan, Paddy Keenan, they called him, Mr. Keenan. Well, he died not very long ago, I think. He was working for immigration in Winnipeg here. He was a real good RSM, I mean. Regimental man, I mean, he could give you a command, you know, on the parade square. I don't care if he was standing a quarter of a mile from you, you'd hear, every man would hear him. Good word of command, you know. Well, he was trained all his life. He was a military man since he was a little boy. And Tugby, you heard of Tugby? You know, the one that went bad during the war when he was a prisoner?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I was not in the same camp. Supposed to, him and another guy, Harvey, is supposed to beat up this freezing to death or something in the camp. Well, there was a big court-martial about it here after the war. But, like, I don't know anything about it. I was not in the same camp. But I knew him. He was in Bermuda with me. He was picked out for that Guard of Honor. He was our sergeant major for the 3 months we were there, you know. And I'm telling you the truth. There's nothing that man could do wrong as far as military. He was all military from top to bottom. You went on the praise corps, you had to do what he wanted you to do, and that's all. Like, he had good men, you know. But the reinforcement, I'll tell you, most of our men we lost in Hong Kong were mostly men we picked up when we come back from Jamaica. We picked them up here, took them. A lot of them never fired a rifle. They didn't even know us full arm, some of them. And we were only there about 3 weeks before the war started.
Yeah.
So what chance did they have? They got on the hill, they didn't know nothing, you know.
Well, you came back from Bermuda and Jamaica, and you were in Winnipeg for about 3 weeks.
Something like that, yeah.
Yeah, this was leave, was it?
Yeah, kind of leave, and they were telling us, well, we heard rumors that we were going to go to Nanaimo for a rest, 6 months. You know, 6 months of rest, and just take military training, you know. First thing we know, they're shooting us with tropical clothes again. So, where are we going?
Did you hear where you were going? Did you know?
No. We didn't know. As far as we were concerned, when we got to Vancouver, we still figured we were going to Nanaimo. But they put us on an Australian ship, so what could you figure where you're going then?
Mm-hmm.
So then we decided maybe we were going to Australia.
Yeah.
Australian ship, eh?
Did any equipment go with you between Winnipeg and the coast or all the way to Hong Kong? You went on the train, didn't you?
I went on the train to Vancouver.
Yeah. Did everyone go on the train?
Yes. And some jumped the draft going. I don't know how many did, but quite a few I hear. I found out after. I think it must have been about maybe 12 or 14 of them jumped. I saw some after I come back that did jump. Well, some of them got 6 months. Military jail, you know, maybe a year somewhere. Well, I guess if we wouldn't know where we're going, quite a few would have jumped, who knows? But I don't think so, because, you know, you're in the service. Like, when we went to Jamaica, we're kind of glad we're going there.
Yeah.
You don't really know what you're facing, you know? And say if they would have sent Hong Kong to us, even. Well, yourself, you never been to Hong Kong, eh?
Mm-hmm.
You're young, you say, well, I want to see Hong Kong, eh? I'm going to see, Chinese women and everything else, you know, you're happy to go. Sure. You don't think of fighting. You don't think of the war.
I was just wondering what kind of things that you would take with you when you went. Did you carry most of your gear and stuff with you?
Oh, yes. We issued all new equipment because, see, when we're in Jamaica, we're like, for more like a non-permanent force because we wash our scrub our. Are you? I'll get you an ashtray. Hey, we wash and scrub our. The web equipment, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like we scrub them white and we polish the brass. We're a spit and polish company, you know? I mean, regiment.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, our boots, everything. You know, all our. You know what our brown the equipment is? The pouches and everything else? The web equipment? Well, it's brown, eh? Khaki. Would you believe that will come white as that piece of paper you got? From scrubbing? Everything was white and all the brass was all polished every day. Even the packs, everything. The belts. Everything was beautiful, you know, like we'd go on parade. It just sparkled. You know, you couldn't believe that the equipment would go so white. Everything was white. The big pack on the back, everything was white. So they had to give us everything new to go into battle because you could see them for miles, you know. Even the shoes.
Was it same type of equipment that you...
Oh, yeah, same type. Oh, yeah, the equipment is standard, you know. And we got also an issue with, the Tommy guns we didn't carry at all times. On the ship, we took training, like Tommy gun training and all that, you know. Well, we never had Tommy gun in Hong Kong. We didn't train on Tommy guns. Maybe the odd ones, but nothing to talk about. We took brand gun and machine gun. And rifle. Mostly after Hong Kong, after Jamaica, we got in Jamaica was mostly brand gun. Brand gun and rifles, that's all, because it's an infantry unit, you know, like you fight the field, you know. It's like you march behind tanks and it's all that stuff, you know. You got an idea what infantry is. Eh? And the machine gun, well, you don't. You just sit and you set a nest with number one and two, you know. You got your ammunition, you got your water, and you cool the machine gun as you fire, you see. Like it's too heavy to carry around. Well, you carry it around on your back and all that, but there's number one, two, and three. Carry the tripod, the water, and, you know.
So you never took any of that equipment with you when you went?
Oh, yes.
Oh, you did?
Mm-hmm. Well, but mostly the training we took on the ship was guerrilla fighting and arm combats, like judo and all that kind of training. You know.
You remember much of the voyage going over?
Quite a bit, but the only thing, like on the ship, they didn't tell us anything. About 24 hours out of Hong Kong, they call us on top of the deck, and the colonel got on the top, you know, and he said, boys, I want to say goodbye to all of you, you know, because as far as we know, we're going to Hong Kong, and tomorrow morning we might have to fight our way off the ship. You know, might be every man for himself, you know. And he wanted to say goodbye to all of us because as far as he knew, there was no comeback, you know. Well, it got kind of silent on the ship, you know. I'll never forget it. I don't think anybody said boo all day. Well, you know, you're thinking about it. Well, where are we going into, you see? But we didn't have to fight our way off the ship. Like we went to Kowloon in the camp, the garrison of Shemshipo. And we're there. I was there about a week, and then it took me, like, different companies went into the hills in Hong Kong, you know, like mountains, you know. And we had pillboxes in the hills. I never seen pillboxes in my life. So we took training for the pillbox, like grenades and everything. You know. And when the war started, I was up in the hills. I was still in the hills, and I remember we looked down over from Hong Kong over Kowloon, and we could see that you know, bombing, like with planes, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, the camp would be, I guess, here, by Kowloon?
Yeah, Kowloon. Mm-hmm, that's it.
I guess when you came in, the ship would dock where, on Hong Kong or in Kowloon? Do you happen to remember?
I can't recall to you. Well, we didn't know the places here.
Yeah.
No, it must have docked on the Kowloon side because, like, we got off and we... Yeah, it had to dock on Kowloon side because we got off the ship and walked down the street, you know, with all our equipment, you know. And if we would have docked on this side, we would have taken a boat across, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it was in Kowloon, yeah, the dock in Kowloon where we landed. And right. We didn't walk very far, I mean, maybe a couple of
couple of miles, well, all through the camp.
Did you march through the city?
Yeah, through the city, and well, it was kind of odd, you know. It's all balconies, and all the buildings are all together, you know. And it's all a big balcony, and with all the writing on the front, well, you don't know what it means. And they all have little flags, and you couldn't believe it. It's different altogether than here, you know. They were very friendly people. Try to be nice to us, and a lot of beggars, kids. Well, I'm French myself, and I thought they could speak French, because when the little kids, they all say, comme ci, comme ça, comme ci, comme ça. Well, comme ci, comme ça in French is like this or like that, you know. But them, well, I figured they could speak French, because they all said that same word, you know. Comme ci, comme ça, comme ci, comme ça, asking you for something. Well, we're begging for pennies, eh? And we felt sorry for them. We're getting change, and we're getting pennies. And the money was just like our money. But, for example, our money was worth about $3 or $4 to theirs. $1, you get four of theirs, you know. And for 5 cents, for an example, you could buy a chocolate bar. Same as here. We were like a bunch of officers. Hey, I'm telling you, Petey, we had a roll like this. Money. Money was no problem, you know. And when the war started, we were kind of sorry, because we didn't really have time to. We got to know the island a little bit, but nothing like, well, imagine, it was a beautiful place, and like the money we're getting, lots we could do, you know. And Jamaica and Bermuda, we couldn't, we didn't have the money. Because 2-3 days after Petey, we were bumming cigarettes off each other, and after time we didn't smoke for another week, you know, waiting for Petey. And that's what I like about Hong Kong. And there was a few Chinese fellas would come around the camp, and they'd shave you. 5 cents.
You marched down the street, and I guess you marched right out to the camp?
Oh, yes. And
it was a nice camp?
Fairly nice. Ordinary. The military camp, you know. It was, how could I explain it? They had a wonderful parade square. And the building was all huts, you know, like separate buildings. Just like in Bermuda, the beds were made out of steel. You open it up and you had, they call them biscuits. Just just a few cushions. You stretch them out, you know, you put your sheet over top of it, tuck them in, you go to bed at night, and you wake up in the morning, maybe the middle cushion on the floor, and you're laying on the steel. You know, that's kind of steel strapping. Could never keep them in place. I don't know if they could sleep in there all the time, but oh, I'm telling you, you wake up with a broken back, you know. Or maybe two of them were on the floor, and you're laying on the steel, running for your bed every morning, you know. And then you close them up, you know. Of course, the foot, what, halfway underneath the other one, pile all your cushions on top and fold all your sheets and blankets a certain way on top of that. It looked nice, you know, and neat. And like every morning when we opened them up, like for inspection, you had to lay everything down, you erase your equipment. Everything laid out, you know, bayonet, polish, everything. And then they check that out, and then you fold all your blankets, right? Then they come around again, check your beds, you know. It was really strict. Well, we used to complain a lot, but nothing to do with the island. And Jamaica, Bermuda, Hong Kong was about the same thing. As far as the camp, they were all terrible.
Kind of,
oh, yes. Well, the beds, I can't recall too much about Hong Kong as far as the bed. You know, you got, at first we noticed that quite a bit, you know. But different camps, then we just laid down, eh? But we didn't have that kind of bed. We didn't have the beds with these cushions, like we had mattresses in Hong Kong. I like that better. And then, like I said, these Chinese fellas would come around at first, we're scared of them, you know, and ask you, they say, shavy, Canada, shavy? Sometimes, well, wait for the next guy to say yes, eh? Yeah, straight razor. And she'd give you a shave for 5 cents. Well, I'm not kidding you, after a few days, like, you only get your own barber, like, and every day you come around shaving you 5 cents, eh? I've seen me shave before I wake up. But, you know, at first, if they would have done that, well, I wouldn't sleep even. I'd be too scared to go to sleep. He'd wake up, you're all shaved. He's waiting for his nickel. You couldn't believe it, how smart they were, you know. And they never, like some of us, you know, we charged so petty. They always got their money. Even in Jamaica, like we used to have little laundry women, you know, like they carry all the dirty clothes on their head on the big bundle, walk in the hills and wash different clothes, different soldiers, and you pay your one payday, you know. And I'm telling you, they start your clothes. You could just put your shorts, you know, your tropical shorts. Could put them up like this, open the leg, and they stand right up, stiff. You know, even the shirt. Well, he made a good job. I don't know what kind of starch they used, but everything was stiff. Your shirt, yeah, you could hardly put your arms in it. Well, it looked nice. I liked it. But Hong Kong, we didn't have a chance to get organized on that. You know, like laundry.
Were you expecting war with the Japanese? Did you expect that at all?
Well, yes, because we figured we might have to fight our way up. That's what became.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
off the boat.
When we got off the boat, you see. But it didn't last very long, like I said, about three weeks, we're in action.
During that 3 weeks, did you sort of expect, after you found
out
you didn't have to fight your way up the boat,
were
you expecting the Japanese to attack, or did you really know it?
Oh, yes, they had an idea they would, you know, but they didn't know exactly when they would attack, you see. And this one morning, first thing we know, we're in the hills, bombing over Kowloon. That's where it started.
Well, what did you do in the 3 weeks? Was there training involved in that time?
All training, like mostly in the hills. They take different bunches out and it's in the hills all the time, guerrilla fighting.
What were you doing at that time? What kind of training were you doing?
A pillbox. I was in the hills taking like guerrilla fighting in the hills, you know. And how to work in the pillbox, how to fight from the pillbox, and how to protect yourself. You know, and make sure you don't get cooped in there and they can drop a grenade on top and, you know, away you go, you see.
Was this on Hong Kong?
Yes, Hong Kong. That was the first pillbox I was in my life. I didn't even know what they were. Mm. Like a sit dog out inside the mountain, you know, with one door and a little chimney on top. And they had them all over the place, you know.
Do you know if they've been built fairly recently or?
Oh, no, they might have been there a long time, years. And like we had machine guns in there. And they had holes, you know, like to fire through.
What kind of machine guns?
Vickers.
Vickers.
We had Vickers brand guns and Tommy guns. And we also had the 2-inch motor. These little motors, you heard of them, drop a bomb and fire them, they go poof, poof. You see them in shows, you know. One guy lays down, the other one drops a little bomb in there. Well, they're very accurate. And the Japs had a little motor, they tie on their knee with a strap, you know. Bend their knee like this. Lay the motor here, it's strapped on their leg. And they were very accurate with that. And they called it the 1-inch motor. Oh, if we would have had that, man, that was good. They tied that on their knee and just shoot it anywhere, you know. Well, they could... Well, I'm telling you, they did a lot of damage because the bombs are about that long, you know. Mm-hmm. You, like, say you're about maybe 400 or 500 men fighting them. And say in a bunch of about maybe 200 or 300 of them, they had about 4 or 5 or 10 of these little motors, you know, tied to their knee. Boy, they didn't even have to, well, they had to aim a certain, you know, a certain point, but they still could hit anybody. You know, all they had to do is fire in that direction and they're bound to kill somebody. Mm-hmm. Oh,
very
effective, especially, say they're on this this part of the mountain, and there's another mountain starting on the other side and we're on the other bank, eh? Well, they shoot from this bank to the other with these little motors. They didn't have to see us. Could be in the branches or anywhere they'd get you. Oh, you couldn't believe how terrible it was.
Do you remember which company you were in?
D company. Well, they brought us from Hong Kong to the mainland at first, like I said, to help this regiment to come out of there. And we went in and they retreated. And we set the machine guns with pencils, you know, long belts, set a nest, and retreated, set another one, and the Japs were stupid. They'd gather in the hills and looking for us, you know, where the nest was, and we'd let them gather maybe 200 or 300 of them or so, and then open another one. That's how we got out of there. We lost only one man. He got hung by the Chinaman. Like he went, I don't know, he went drinking with some Chinese, and they hung him to a tree. He was hanging by the ferry before we crossed back into Hong Kong.
There were Chinese fighting
too? Yeah, well, no, it was fifth colonists. We had a lot of fifth columnists in Hong Kong, you know. You couldn't trust nobody. You could be talking to the Chinaman and he was working to the opposite side, you see. And he's the only one we lost there. Anyway, when we were retreating,
in the hills. I ran across a British soldier. I forgot the name of the regiment we helped in there. But I met him, and he was a Scotty-like, you know. So I asked him if he could drive a vehicle. He said no, because we had an ammunition dump in Hong Kong. Well, I said, I'll tell you, I said, there's two trucks here on the side of the road, military trucks. They were about 3-ton trucks, you know, with a big box on the back. I said, if you can drive, I said, we'll take two of the trucks and take them to the ammunition dump, steal it, take ammunition and take it to Hong Kong, because we were short, you know. We didn't have too much ammunition or anything like that. So I figured, I'll steal ammunition and take it to Hong Kong. Well, he said, I can't drive. Well, I said, okay, so I'll show you what to do. So I'll get you going, but don't speed, you know. I'll get in front of you, you follow me, and when you get to where we're going, just put your foot on the brake, on the clutch, and hold it there. And I'll come and take it out of gear and everything, you know. He said, okay. Well, we're fighting on the street there, right in the city, you know. The Japs are coming over the hills just like bees. The hills are all moving, you know, we're coming over the top. Said okay, so we managed to steal these two trucks off the road there, and we went to this dump. And I said, you cover me while I load the ammunition. I was bigger than he was, and he was short, like, you know, he was Scotch, you know, very small fellow, very nice guy. You know? So I said, I load the ammunition, you cover me. And they had on the side of the mountains, they had like gullies, you know, for the water, you know, and. First thing we found, we noticed there was a bunch of a platoon, they would say, maybe 14, 15 Japs coming up this side of this mountain, you know, in the drain, like. And they start coming over the top, and we each had a Tommy gun. So as they were popping up, he's shooting them. He kept me covered so I could load. I loaded the two trucks. We got going, and we took them to the ferry. And when we got close to the ferry was on the wrong side of the river. And they had two ferries. One ferry was for car, and one was for trucks, vehicles, you know. So we happened to hit the ferry. The regular ferry was a place for cars. And I didn't know that this Chinaman driving this ferry was a fifth columnist. So when we parked on the side of the water there, and the Japanese coming down the street, you know. So I said to him, I said, we'll carry a box of grenades. We had grenades and everything we loaded. I said, we'll move it quite a ways from the truck on the street. And we'll hide behind pillars with our Tommy guns, one on each side. And if they come towards us, well, we're finished, eh? We haven't got much of a chance. But where can we go? Oh, they were like bees. I don't know what it was. And I said, we'll aim from them a big box of grenade we got there. Case, like, you know. We'll let them get close to it, a big bunch of them, and blow them all up. That's what we got in our big mind. But they changed direction. I don't know what happened. They just happened to change direction. All of a sudden, going in a different direction. So we didn't have to fire. So we picked up that box again, put it back on the vehicle. And I said, now, I said, the ferry's coming across. So we got there. So the Chinese fella driving the ferry, he said, no, cars, you know. And we had these kind of rods on top, oops, you know, for tarps and army trucks. Well, he said, you're too high, you know. I don't care. I said, cover him with the Tommy gun and I'll drive it on. You know? So I drove one truck on and all the big bars are breaking. And I drove the other one on and took him across and got across the ferry. So this Scotty got him. For not, I don't know, he said, well, he was fifth columnist, as far as you could see. And he shot him. And then we took the ammunition, unloaded it.
This was back on Hong Kong?
Yeah, we took to Hong Kong the ammunition. Well, I was reported missing there. I was reported missing. And I showed up the next morning at one. I knew my regiment was, my company was in One Nation already. I mean, One Chai Gap already, on the hill, where we first trained.
Well, where did you start off? Do you remember? Could you point it out on the map? You said you were in the pillbox.
Yeah, if I can see. I just mentioned the place.
Kowloon.
No, that's I started in Kowloon.
Here's One Chai Gap here.
One Chai, that's where we fought.
Mm-hmm.
That's where we fought, and then we went towards Mount Nicholson.
That's where they had that big battle, you know, on Nicholson. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I got wounded crossing from Wanchai to Mount Nicholson. Mount Cameron. You see, this Mount Nicholson should be around here somewhere. Mount Nicholson, right mm-hmm. here. See? We were gone from Wanchai Gap across here, I guess, you know? And this is where I got wounded on this hill here somewhere. I was on my way here. And on my way here, well, there was about, not very many of us left. Anyway, there was a sniper on this bank here somewhere. Mm-hmm. And he got the two Kelso brothers, who were corporals, both got in about 15 minutes. And a few more of them, you know, forget the names now. And I jump on this road, and I was getting sniped at. I was going up the mountain, you know. And I was zigzagging, laying down, getting up and firing back, but I couldn't tell where it's coming from, trying to figure out, you know. And you know where he was? He was behind a tree, shape of a tree with a hole, like a branch has been rotted out. That's where he was firing from. And I'm going up this road, and on the mountains they had a kind of a piece of cement with a culvert going under the road, and it would stop the bank from coming under, you know. See, there was a kind of a 3x3 square place to hold the mountain, and then this culvert, you could go in there, it was maybe about this deep, eh? So I come over the top of this part, this culvert. Well, I didn't really was looking for one, but I heard a noise like a moan, real moan, and it's bothering me. I could tell somebody heard it. I listen, and I'm still busy dodging this guy sniping at me. So the voice is getting away because I'm going past it, eh? So it's bothering me. I gotta go back, you know. And the way he's chasing me with them bullets, I mean, going back is pretty rough. I figure I'm gonna go find out. I went back, I zigzagged back, and I jumped into that hole to protect myself. See, there's a bank there in the road. I mean, you can't hurt me in there as long as you don't come close and shoot me. So I realized the moaning's coming from in this big hole, like this culvert. So I stooped down to look in it. As I look in it, you can't see because you plugged a hole. And he's in part of it, so there's no light at the other end because he's in there. So I feel kind of fishy. I figure, well, it might be a Jap. Who knows? Maybe I'll just go in there a bit and he'll blow my head off there. Because he's still alive. He's moaning. So anyway, I crawled in there and I'm feeling around and I felt the shoes. They were British shoes, like leather boots, you know. I knew it was a British or Canadian, but I knew it was one of ours. So, because the Japs had these split running shoes with split toes, you know, like running shoes and canvas, and one split toe for the big toe. Well, right away, I knew it was one of our men. I was pretty relieved, you know. So I asked him if he could move. He kept on moaning. He didn't talk. So I pulled on his leg. I said, move, I'll pull you back, you know. So he's backing up with me, you know, pulling him back. So I sat him in the corner, like in the cement place there. His chin was shut off here, you know. And he gave up, you see. He was crawling there to die, I guess. He gave up. Just shaking away. So I said, come on, let's go. And he's a fairly tall man. He worked for the post office now in Winnipeg. He's back home, you know.
He was a grenadier?
Oh, yes. He's back home. He's a deer hack. He lives in Norwood. Mm-hmm. He was living in Norwood. He was... And the barber in Norwood there, I forget the man's name when I used to live there. He was married to his daughter. Anyway, I got him in there and I said, come on, let's go. He won't come, you know. Well, I said, okay, if you're not coming, I'm going to finish you myself. Might as well be me as a Jap or you die here. So I put my Tommy gun on him. I said, are you coming? I said, you got to help yourself. And I just got out, pull him up. As I got him out of there, you know, got him decided to come along, I'm dragging him. He don't want to come. He can't talk. I got hit here, see. Just tore this open.
In the arm?
Yeah, got wounded, see. Went right through here. I don't know what position I was in, but went through there and this was all cut open. Doesn't show our leg, but the scar's there yet. I had a pair of these coveralls, army coveralls, and a Kerrigan sweater on the inside.
And when it hit me, I kind of paralyzed, you know. I don't know if it affects everybody the same, but all this side seemed to be... So I just flopped, eh? So I said, I'm dead. Well, he didn't talk, but he heard me. I said, I'm dead. So I realized I'm alive yet. So I knew it was burning. I'm still numb, you know. So I said to myself, well, I've got to get out of here, pick myself up. No, just before that, he started firing pretty heavy again.
This was the sniper?
Yeah. But I had him down too, my buddy, you know. So anyway, I got this jack. He come out. You see, they come out to see if you got gold in your mouth or a watch. The more gold they get in their mouth, when they die, they get a better funeral or something. That's what I was explaining, you know. And they did that to all the soldiers that they could reach them after they shot them. Steal rings and watches and stuff like that. So I'm waiting for him. So I held my buddy down, I laid down, I said, okay. Lem could come real close. And when he got real close, I opened the Tommy gun at a round magazine, I emptied it in his body. Before he fell, they had it all in here. He made a big hole in him. Now, I'm telling you the truth, I was dissatisfied. I turned his head in. That hobnail in my shoe, oh, you couldn't believe the grudge you get, you know, after a while. Trumped his head in, and then we got to it. They call them ET station, like a post, like you see, you can get morphine or for, you know, after you're wounded and get treated, you know, till you get to a hospital. So that must have been about 2 miles from there. And on the way there, I had nothing to eat for quite a few days.
Did you go by yourself?
We're dragging this one, yeah. So there was a little building on the side of the hill. We're looking for food as we're going along. And I walked in there, there was no loaf of bread, part of it missing, you know, it's been used, kind of moldy and all that. So I dug the worst part off and ate that. Well, he couldn't eat. So we got to this ET station. Maybe it was needle, I don't know. Anyway, they had these little British ambulances. One come there, there was an Indian, a Gurkhas, laying there, and me and him. And they put us on stretchers and load us up into this little ambulance. And we're going up the road. They took us to Bone Road Hospital. I was never there before. It was a... Bone Road, I think, was... No, that was a regular hospital. It was Prince Albert that was turned into a monastery, into a hospital. Got there, and they took us in there. And all the way down, they were shelling us with this... Not shelling us, but scraping with planes, you know, following us. Man, we had no planes to fight back, eh? They could dive at us like birds. All the crooked road there, I don't know how that plane didn't get all of us in that little ambulance, but they're shooting at us. We had to go about 5 miles on this mountain. They got us down there, they unloaded us, and I'm not kidding you. I'll tell you the honest truth, I saved his life. They opened his tunic, you know what fell out of his tunic? About 15, 20 chocolate bars. When I saw that coming out of his tunic, he said, you know what? He said, if I wouldn't know what you had there, I said, you'd be dead. So I would have killed you for sure. You know, after they fixed his chin, I think they put a rubber thing on you and everything. You know what he told me? I asked him in the hospital, I said, how come you didn't offer me some of the food? You could eat it, you know? He knew I didn't have no food. Well, he said, I was saving it for later. Isn't that terrible, eh? And I'm helping him. And you know who got the food? The nurses and the orderlies. They got the chocolate bars. So anyway, young nurse come over to me. I'm laying on the stretcher. She said, I guess you're hungry. I said, I think I am.
Just what?
She said, I guess you're very hungry. I said, I am very hungry. Well, she said, I'm very sorry. She said, all we got is cold stew. Well, I said, bring the cold stew. Anything goes, you know. But imagine after, I don't know how many days I was without food and hardly any water. So she gave me a bit of stew, cold stew. And then they put me on, they took like our rifle away in that. I went berserk. So they took my Tommy gun and my rifle. I went mad because I figured, what can I defend myself with now, you know? And they put me into this bed in the corner there by the chimney. And they put a mattress over top of me. I think they tied me down. Well, I went really berserk when they took everything away from me. I figured, that's it. You don't take that stuff away from me because I was trained that rifle never leaves me. See? Crazy soldier, you know?
And I was never like in military hospital like that. I don't know nothing. I don't know what's going on after you're in there. So they tied me underneath this mattress. And you won't believe it. I bet you I was not in that bed an hour. And a bomb from a plane hit the chimney. I was buried with bricks, you know? Well, I think that's what saved me is the mattress, sure. Because I know a few fellas got killed. I don't know how many, but a few got killed in the hospital. And I'm telling you, you want to see a guy that was wild after. Oh, I was all the time I was in there, I'm not lying to you, I was looking for my Tommy gun and my rifle. Never found it. I don't know what.
Do you remember about what day this would be? Because the battle went on, I guess, for 17 days.
No, started, 28 started, days, wasn't it?
Yeah, it started on the 7th and it finished on the 20th. Started on the 7th and finished on the 25th. The final surrender was on the 25th.
Yes.
I was just wondering if you remembered when the war started. Do you remember how you knew that the war was on?
Well, the only time I knew when I saw this bombing down the hill, I didn't even know about it. We figured it was on. We had only a couple of planes. And all I seen them, we seen them go up and come down again. That's all. They were so old, them two old planes they had there. I don't know what year.
British planes. British.
Yeah, two or three of them. That's all that I know of. Yeah. The one with the double wings, you know? Mm-hmm. I think they had in the first war. I don't know. Mm-hmm. Never seen planes like it. And all I remember, they left the ground, they were shot down right away.
They didn't get very far at all?
I don't think they got 2 miles in the air. Maybe one got about 3 miles. Who knows?
Yeah, you were able to watch them take off.
Oh yes, we're watching them. They were bombing the camp, you know. Oh yeah, they bombed all that side first, you know, and then we knew we were at war. Mm-hmm.
Were you in a pillbox at this time?
I was in the hills. Pillbox training, you know. Mm-hmm. Well, we're staying there.
Oh, you still undergoing training at this time? You weren't at the battle station?
No, we were there. We're in the hills training. We didn't expect it. It just happened in the morning. It started, bang, that was it.
Did you have a radio or anything? Did you remember if you had a radio?
Oh, yeah, they had radios. Oh, yeah, we were getting news and all that. And they could talk like brigade headquarters. They were in the hills already. They were stationed right there at Wanishan. Wanishan Gap, yeah, that's what it is. Name of it. Yes, yes. Wanishan Gap.
You were in Hong Kong when it started? Or Kowloon? I got a little confused there.
I said one Shy Gap, it's one Leshan Gap. Well, one Shy Gap, I was right, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Where, you were on Hong Kong Island when it started?
When the war started?
Yeah.
I was on the island, but in the hills, you know?
In the hills, training.
Yeah, I was there about a week already, you know, in the hills.
Did you have much equipment with you, or food, or anything like that?
Well, as far as food, before the war started, we had no problem to tell you how much food they had, I don't know. You know, we were getting our rations.
Yeah, I was just wondering about your group of men, your company, you weren't training. I was just wondering if you had food and equipment. And
in the hills? Oh, yes. Well, for the amount of men we had enough equipment, but as far as planes, we had nothing. And as far as big guns, well, they had that Gurkhas and Punjabis. Mm-hmm. They're supposed to have big guns on this little island. Kaitak or something, the name of this little island. I never was on it, you know. They were supposed to be firing these big guns from there, these cannons. But I've never seen them. Mm-hmm. How many they had, like I say, there was only a few men of each regiment there. So how much could they have? Mm-hmm. To my concern, I mean, for the amount of Japanese people that hit the island, we're about maybe, let's say, I forget, 200 to 1 or something, or more than that. And they had planes, and they had ships beside. It was coming from all angles, you couldn't defend yourself.
Yeah, I know it's a long time, a number of years ago, but I was just wondering, from the day that the war started, when you saw the actual bombing, mm-hmm. the planes get shot down, till you started fighting the Japanese, I just wondered what took place in that time.
Well, that's when they brought us down. And they were fighting in the mainland, this regiment already, which I didn't know about it. Yeah. In the mainland, about 7 miles. It was started already, but we didn't know about it. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But you saw the planes.
Yeah, but the officers must have known about the mainland, the fighting in the mainland. We heard they were fighting in the mainland, but where, we didn't know. Yeah. But anyway, when they started in Kowloon, right away they brought our company from the hills, brought us across back to the mainland, the 69 of us, and took us on with machine guns
inland about 3 miles, and we stayed there for, like I say, maybe 1 or 2 days, I forget now. And it was a 9.2, big gun, 25 mile range, was a British gun, firing. And we're, I don't know, maybe a quarter of a mile from it, a mile, who knows, half a mile, I don't know. And they ask us to take a rest, you know, try and sleep as much as we can. So we're laying there, and when this big gun would fire, the shell would go over the top of us like this, you know. I'm not lying to you, when they fired, even the bottom of your trousers would vibrate, you know. We're trying to sleep.
And you're trying to rest.
Yeah, every, I'd say about every 2 minutes or shell would go, you know.
Yeah.
And it's going over us, eh? Oh, you couldn't believe the noise. You go, oh, we're scared to that, eh?
Yeah.
And then the next morning, they made us go into the hills for 7 miles, and they start scraping us with planes, you know. So maybe we would have went further, but we had to leave our vehicles. So we start spreading in the hills, and that's where it started. I forget how long we fought there. We didn't fight too long in there. But like I said, we're backing up all the time trying to get this regiment out of there. We didn't have too much problem. The only thing, they were mostly in rags, all of them already. They'd been fighting quite a while in there.
These were Canadians? Or
no, British. British regiment. Mm-hmm. That's when we took out, the ones we took out of there. And they stole the ammunition. Well, in my mind, you know, war is war. It's not that I was trying to be a big hero doing that. I was just figuring, well, we might need it. I don't know what they got, eh?
Yeah.
So, at the same time, while I got the Scotty helping me, I'm thinking to myself, well, we're going to get maybe court-martial for what I'm doing, because you're not supposed to touch military stuff, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Unless you're ordered. So I didn't care. I brought it along.
Did any officers say anything to you about it?
No. I got back to my regiment, you know, in the hills. I was late a few days. And the time I was there only that afternoon, and we got below the pillbox about around midnight. We could hear noise in the valley there, you know.
This is near Wan Chai Gap.
Yeah, Wan Chai Gapman, Happy Valley was below us, you know. We could hear the noise, like, below, in that mountain there. Well, maybe, they weren't far from us. Maybe twice the width of this house, maybe 300-400 yards. We could hear noise in the branches, talking and all that. And we couldn't tell, because we didn't know what the Indians sounded like, you know, or the Gurkhas and Punjabis. We thought they were.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know. And it was Sergeant Tom from Transcona. He's about 6 foot. I don't know if you interviewed him yet.
Mm-hmm.
He's about 6 foot. Six of them, big man. He was in charge of us laying there, and I don't know how come I was under a motor, you know, these two inch motor we had. I was on a motor with this young chap, and I remember Sergeant Tom said to me to fire, you know, one shot over the top. I'll never forget it. That one shot, then you couldn't hear yourself talk. They started to fire back. Eh? I never seen so much lead in all my life. Where it come from, I don't know. All you could hear is zing, 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 all over the place. You know, even if you talk to somebody, he couldn't hear you.
These are rifle shots and machine guns.
Rifle shots, machine guns, everything. Was motors. Oh, was I a sorry boy? I fired that thing.
So you knew it was the Japanese. Man.
Well, that's where we lost our company.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I bet you by 11 o'clock in the morning, hardly any of us left.
Were you in pillboxes, or you just...
No. Well, we were fighting by the pillboxes.
Mm.
No way.
But you weren't inside.
No, I wouldn't go in there. Well, there was a few in there, the Japs got them in there. You know. But the sniper...
It wasn't such a good place to be, in a pillbox?
Not there, because, there was too many Japs.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't have enough men to protect yourself. And, well, like, they told us everything was for... And they told us... We started fighting, everything was for ourselves. Never surrendered. Well, that was the biggest mistake, because I know a lot of our boys died. They were finding them maybe 10 days, 14 days after. They were still coming out of the hills. And someone gave up. They fight to the end. Eh? They wouldn't give up to anybody. They wouldn't surrender. Because you're all scattered all over the place. There was no organized... There was nothing organized. Like I said, fight for yourself and fight for your life.
Is this what the officer said? Or is
yeah. There was
You just had to do the best that you could, that's all. No, we didn't have a chance. We're just like a bunch of cattle being slaughtered. You know, on the side, one day, the first morning, when they come from Hong Kong, from the mainland to Hong Kong, the machine guns on the side, firing across, they were crossing into these sampans, you know, like these Chinese boats. The more you kill, the more they come. They walked over the machine guns, and the machine guns were all red. Red hot, firing steady, never stopped them. I don't know how many thousand men hit the other. Well, I got a book on it, I got a big book on it. I forget, I used to know. They were, and when they got us there, you know, when they surrendered, I was in hospital already. You know. And from this place, they transferred me from Bone Road, they transferred me to this Prince Albert.
Was this the English that transferred you, or the Japanese?
The hospital.
The hospital transferred me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. When they surrendered, I was transferred already to this other hospital. Mm-hmm. It was a monk place, like Catholic monks, and they turned that into a hospital. Already they had a bunch of Gurkhas and Punjabis on the second floor. Boy, arms off, legs off, you know, all. They really got it. They were shelled from the sea, but they had cannons, these fellas. The guys fight with knives. And they got us in there, and I think it was in there only a couple of days. Then the Japs, they start sniping at the hospital. And the shelling was quite heavy on one side, so they put us in the halls, you know, in the hospital, in this convent. It was all marble floors, and they had big, big windows at each end, these square little glass that you can't see through. And the Chinese, the Japanese were firing from both hands, you know. And I've heard after that there was a few soldiers on top of the hospital that caused it. I don't know if it's true. They were firing at the Japs from the hospital, and that's how the Japs happened.
That's why the Japs
started. But did you hear that before?
No.
Well, I don't know. You know what I mean? I don't know how true it was, but they said that.
You were in the hallway.
Yeah, I was in the hallway. Well, a lot of the boys got hit there by the sniping to the hospital. I was talking to, I think it's Ostachuk. He's from Winnipeg here. You might interview him. He was sitting on his bed. He was wounded already. And I was talking to him. He was sitting like facing towards the big window, you know, by the middle of the hallway. And they start firing from that end. And they were like, the bullets were bouncing on the marble floors and hitting legs of bed and all that. He got it right here in the face. And I was talking to him. He fell backward after the breeze. He's had it, you know. But he lived. He was very sick for about maybe 18 days, 18, 19 days. You know. I think they didn't think he'd survive, but he did. He's back here. And they come in the hospital. I'll tell you about this. Oh yeah, they come into the hospital, and they ask, Ufak, that this one nation gap.
Do you know if this was after the surrender or before the surrender?
Well, that's after the surrender. I was in the hospital. Well, it's hard to tell, you see, because I was inside the hospital. I did, you know, they didn't give us much news. It's only a few days after.
I was just wondering if you heard about the surrender.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, I didn't finish that. Anyway, they sniped in the hospital. And then they got into the hospital. Just the sergeants and maybe a few privates, see? Mm-hmm. They got in there and they started looting watches. A few of them looting watches, and then this officer come in later. Everybody that couldn't walk, I won't say everybody, but lots of them, they just ripped them apart, killed them right in the bed, you know. And the ones that could walk, they took us downstairs, they had the, like big lecture rooms, you know, with big doors, like the ones we were in. The nurses were in the back and the orderlies standing up, and the wounded guys with arms wounded and all that, they made us sit in front, and they had the machine gun in this door and that door, facing us with two Japs at each of them. And then this officer come in, he could speak English. And he found out about these fellas looting these watches, I guess. And he told us, Japan don't believe in looting, you know. He told us to show us what they do with people that loot. First he ordered these two Japs to return the watches. How could they? They don't remember where they got them from. They couldn't return them all. So there was a place at the back of this hospital, like this monk place, a cut in the mountain like they use, you know, to play ball game of some sort. I forgot what they call it, but British people play that game a lot, eh? Mm-hmm. Anyway, it's a hand sense. I've seen them play it, but I don't know what it is. they took them there and shot them. The Japanese officer shot them. He said, that's what we do to people that loot. The Japanese don't believe in looting, so watch yourself if you want to live, you know.
He shot his own men.
Oh, yes. And they're raping nurses and everything else, you know. It was terrific. And telling you, the second floor, there was blood running down the steps. And the way they cut them all up, you know, like...
These are the men that couldn't walk.
Yeah, couldn't walk and stuff
nurses.
Like that. Yeah, well, nurses, they mostly raped, you know.
Mm-hmm. Were they killed, you know?
Oh, yeah. Most of them were. Well, you couldn't believe it. Like, I don't know, they were just standing in line. And anyway, they were asking questions. Who fought the One Nation Gap and all that?
The Japanese?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And they took some of the men out of the hospital and took them up on top of that cliff there where this cut out was and tied them with wire, you know, by the testicle and pushed them on the cliff. They figured it was this British regiment that fought there. They lost, that was their heaviest loss they had, you know, the Japanese. One is Mon Nicholson.
Mm-hmm.
And that was terrific.
These were British men that were taken out?
Yeah. And
did this officer, was he there at that time? Do you remember? This Japanese officer? Because he seemed very strict with his own men.
Yeah. No, I think all that dirt was done. No, he was there, I think. I'm pretty sure he was, yeah. They did so many different things, you know. And it's something that, how would I say, you don't pay too much attention because, you know, to you it's just a picture, eh?
Yeah.
I mean, this is done, that's done, a guy was beat up one day, and all you're worried about yourself, really, you figure, well, thank God I didn't get it, you know.
Yeah.
You inside, you get very hard, you know, you don't. And they would have found out that we fought there, some of us, we would have got it too.
It was British soldiers that were taken out?
Yeah, some of them, mostly British, yeah. Not Canadian, no, not there. And I couldn't even tell what regiment it was.
Mm-hmm.
They took some of these fellows, and I can't even tell you how many they killed. And when they took us from to the camp, from the hospital there, I stole a mattress. Big mattress.
At the hospital?
Well, we could, eh? So, take all you want. No, it wasn't stolen. They told us to take all we could carry. If we would, you know, give us comfort in the camp, because we had nothing. I don't know how many miles it was a long ways. So, man, I got a big mattress. Hospital mattress are heavy. I got sheets, pillows. Oh, and, you know, these soup bowl, I forgot what they were made of. I think they were steel. You know, kind of steel aluminum. So I'm thinking of my brother, eh? I got a brother, I don't even know if he's alive, but I'm going to carry this mattress into camp, because if he hasn't got one, I can always split the mattress in half, make a double bed for both of us, eh? Big idea. Well, it was good, my idea was good. I carried everything to this camp. I must have carried that all 3 miles, at least, if not further. Over a hill, and got to the camp. Anyway, I found my brother in there. Glad to see him and all that. He wasn't wounded at all. He had no bed, you know. I forgot what he was laying. He had a gunny sack tied up to 2 pieces of board. We put 2 legs on it, you know. That's what he slept in. So I told him I got this mattress and that I split it open and he could share with me. But really, he was so much. He was the oldest family. I was the youngest. And he always figured I'd try to boss him around, you know. So I want him to move in my hut, and I'll fix this bed. I did fix it. I cut it open. I sewed the sheet. I forgot what I used to sew it. I sewed the sheet on top and the other half. You know, both half together open. Put one sheet, and I got one sheet to cover herself with. So I begged him, one day to come and live with me, you know, in the hut. No, he wouldn't come and stay with me. I said, come on, I'll give you, I had a utensils for him I brought too, you know. I don't know how I carried that load I had, but I sure had a lot of stuff. So he come and stay with me, then he stayed with me a couple of weeks. And then we got mad, he took off. Then he sold his bowl for cigarettes. You know, I gave him, oh, it was mad. He sold that bowl for food, you know. I mean, for cigarettes.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd sell his rice, stuff like that, you know. And I don't know, he landed in the hospital with dysentery and all that. And had a real hard time with him.
I used to try to help him all the time. He never seemed to appreciate what you did for him. It was like that all during the war. Anyway, he stayed in Hong Kong. He got so bad with malnutrition. He got all crippled up with sores. And he was laying in the corner of a hut there in the water. I moved him out of there, you know. And then just before I left the camp, yeah, that's separated, you know, going to Japan. Right? Yeah, I think I was in the third draft going to Japan.
Third
draft, like the third bunch that went. And you got electrical wires, you know. And he was all bloated with this very, very swelling up. He was leaning against the board, you know, in this little hospital we had in the camp, in a little hospital. He had no bed, nothing. And he just pumped up him. He was like that when I left. So I squeezed through the fence, you know, this barbed wire we had. I went to see him, and he was finished. I couldn't take his leg, and he couldn't lay down. He was too swollen. You know? He choked. So I jumped the fence. I give her a shirt, you know, a military shirt, some Chinese words, soybean powder, powdered milk, you know. I got back into the camp, and I sneaked back into where he was. And I went there and I mixed it in the can, little can, you know, like some kind of bucket, you know, like pea can or, you know, that you use for canning. I mixed that in there with water, you know, that soybean milk, and I wanted him to drink it. He'd give up, you know, he wouldn't do it. So I grabbed him by the collar and I said, "You drink this, or I'll finish you myself." I shoved the gag and everything, poured it into him. And then I left, you know. I figured he never lived, you know, because he gave up. He was crying and everything. So I left and I got into the other side and I went into Japan. Never saw him again until after the war.
He made it then?
Oh, yes. Well, they told me, the boys I was in the hospital with him there, you know, suffering from the same disease, very, very late. They told me after I poured the soybean milk into him, about 2 hours later, you see, your kidneys quit working, you see. That's how you get this beriberi. He lost 14 or 15 pounds overnight. Water, you know, going out of his system.
Oh.
Anyway, you know where I saw him again? I come out as a sailor. You see, they drop, out of parachute, the Americans, they drop all kinds of clothes, you know, for us. Like some were soldier uniforms, some was naval uniforms. Anyway, I ended up, I was a sailor. I had a white uniform. So I met my brother in San Francisco. I didn't tell him I was his brother. So I found out he was alive, so I looked him up, you know. I told the boys not to tell him I was alive. He's telling about the brother he lost, you know. So I talked to him, and on the train, first we went to Fort McDowell across the water there, like this big garrison for a few weeks, and they got us back to Frisco, and then we got on a train to Seattle. All this time I'm following him on the train and I'm sticking close to him, you know. And we got the corner of the train. We are a bad little bunch, you know. So you know what, they got the beds in, on a train, like the corner, what do you call these places? They got special for people, you know, like a
berth
owner. Yeah, berth. Yeah, but it's a separate berth. You got your private door and everything. So we're about, yeah, we're about four or five of us in there. And we stopped somewhere, the train stopped somewhere, and we all got beer, you know. Well, I think we drank three hotels there. And got my brother in with us. Yeah, he didn't drink much. So we got him really loaded. So when we got to, I think it was Vancouver, they put us on the boat, took us to Victoria, Work Point Hospital. Work Point Camp first. And he was healthy enough to go home, you know. I wasn't. So they transferred me to, they were going to transfer me to Work Front Hospital. And that afternoon I went to see him at his hut. I said, "Would you like to meet your brother, you know?" Well, he said, "Is he alive?" I said, "Yes, I'm the brother." But I was young, you see, I changed a lot, you know. So he started crying, and I knew he was going home, you know. I said, "You're going home?" I said, "I didn't know where our people were, they moved, you know." So I said to him, "So you go and find our people. You want to stay with me in Victoria?" I said, "No, just keep on going, you know." I said, "I'll see you when I get to Winnipeg." So I was 3 months in Work Point Hospital before they even sent me to Vancouver in hospital there. And then they transferred me to Vancouver. At Vancouver, I was 3 months or so in the Shaughnessy Hospital.
Then I got an hospital train to Winnipeg. They unloaded me at the bottom of the station, CNR station, and transferred me from there to Deer Lodge. I don't think it was 6-7 months in there, before I even went out to go home at all, you know. But it took a little while. You know, I found my people from Victoria. You know, the Red Cross?
Mm-hmm.
Found them for us, you know.
I didn't know what even.
Well, we couldn't write. There was no letters, you know. You didn't know nothing. You know?
The monastery that had been turned into a hospital, was that on Kowloon? Or on Hong Kong? But you said you marched from...
Yes, Kowloon? Yes, it was Kowloon. I mean Hong Kong.
It was
on Hong Kong, yes.
And then you went back to camp?
Sham Shui-po. That's where they took us, yeah. Well, all this thing that happened into the camp, you know, like they had civilians at first in the camp. You know? Mothers, no, white. They had the British and children and everything, you know. When I got back there, it was moved already. There was only a few left there. Well, this was the one story there. This woman and father and mother were there, and they had a little girl, 11 years old, that they raped, you know. And they were holding the mother and the father, you know. Mm-hmm. It was terrible. The boys were telling me about it, you know. There's lots went on that I didn't see because I wasn't there yet. You know? And on this death march, one guy, they got one of these brand guns fired up his back, you know. You'll be interviewing him, I guess. Aubrey. He used to work for Vulcan Iron Works. He's married, he's in Winnipeg now. Dr. Crawford picks him up, you know, put his inside back and all that. Come on, that was terrific. But the worst after we got transferred into Japan was starvation.
Well, you stayed in Sham Shui-po for a while?
No, Sham Shui-po for about 8 months. Then I was transferred into Japan.
Do you remember the name of the camp you went to in Japan?
D5 and D15. I can't recall. You heard of the camp that collapsed, eh? The building all went down?
No.
Well, Christmas Eve, I think it was. Somewhere around Christmas. A big storm. There were too many men in the building. And the building crushed down, you know, during the night.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the boys were pinned under the beams, you know. Anyway, we're all with no clothes outside in the storm, you know, trying to lift these beams, the roof, you know, off these guys. We lost 3 men there that died. And the Japs would hit you or kick you over the roof, you know, as you go to lift it. They'll hit you with a rifle, you know, fall over the roof over top of them. Anyway, 3 died there. And from there, they marched us. I think it was D15 that came, or D5, and they transferred us to D15. And one bunch of us, they were working for Sentatsu Shipyard, and me, I was in the bunch that worked in the foundry. I never worked in the shipyard. Like the guys working in the shipyard were pretty lucky too, because lots of time they had breaks, they could steal a bit of fish, you know, dried fish and all that. We never got that. Then I was transferred to this other camp, and I always work in the biggest, supposed to be the biggest foundry in the world. I work in a smelter there, like breaking pig iron. Well, my first job was breaking pig iron with sledgehammer. And I missed the first stroke, I broke the handle, I got knocked out by the Jap. He used a stick, he hit me over the head. He said, Vaquero, you know, in Japanese. Hit me over the head, went down a contour. Then he grabbed my handle, he took off, come back with another one, you know, another sledgehammer. Oof, she got to. Then I was careful. I was on that quite a while. A few of the boys died from the job, you know, really heavy job, you know, all day, 9 hours a day, breaking this big piece of iron, you know. And then they make us load some coke, you know, they use and for melting the steel. These big furnaces, they have 2 floor of the furnaces. You use big baskets to carry about 1/4 ton of coke, like coal, and you dump them in there, a couple baskets of that and a couple baskets of steel, you know, not basket but trays, you know, of steel that you pick up off these piles and dump them in there, because you did all day, you know. And sometimes, you know, you'd be carrying the basket with a pole, you know, 2 guys, well, twice the weight you should carry. And when you put it down, the fella in front bent down, you know, the other guy stayed up a bit to hold it up, you know, so you wouldn't get your back hurt. You know what the Jap would do behind? Give you a kick and you land on top of the tray, you know, or the basket of coal. Oh, And we're loading these trays by hand, and only your bend over, give you a kick, you land on top of the pothead first.
This went on all the time?
They're more like kids. And they laugh, or they come around and give you a slap in the face and laugh. Like in the foundry, we had maybe 200-300 girls and boys, you know, working, painting molds, like they used to make molds for
ships.
Yes. Yeah. Used to make molds for ships. And they take a little bench, walk over to you, climb on top of it, a little kid, slap you in the face or spit in your face and run. Give you a slap. You couldn't do nothing about it. But they felt like that all day.
Well, when you went from Camp Chapeau to is it D-15?
D-5.
D-5?
I'm pretty sure
it was D-5. It all Canadians went?
No, wait a minute. No, there was Marines, American Marines, and some sailors. It was all mixed up, you know. And the D-15 was only about 35 Canadians. All the rest was Americans, mostly Marines. And it was kind of rough for us, you know, because the officer in charge, very nice, was a Marine officer. What was going on, he didn't see too much. But the fellow in charge of the cookhouse, I can't even say his name, I hated him so much. And
in Japanese?
No, we made our own food, you know, like they give us the rations. And he'd be kind of cruel Canadians, you know. Well, if we're all Canadian, you'd favorite Canadian if you were in charge and all that. He was the same. And there was no breaks for the Canadians to work in that cookhouse. Like maybe every 3 months or so, they'd kind of change help in the kitchen, give other guys breaks, you know. They'd all get fat again because they'd get all the rice they wanted in there. And we grew a garden in the camp, and we ate carrot tops for a while, maybe no rice. And if there was any burn rice at night, well, it was divided, you know, but it was favoritism all the way, see. Lots of stuff was going on that I didn't see with my own eyes, but I knew it was going on, you see. Because some of the fellas were gaining weight, and you can't gain weight on nothing, eh? You know what I mean? And this guy in charge of the cookhouse, man, I'll tell you, he was a big, healthy man. He has enough food, eh? And we get, maybe once a week, we'd get the head and the tail of a fish. They eat the fish and save us the tail and the head. So they'd boil them in the pot, you know, a big pot, and they dish them out. You get a head, you get a tail, you get a head, you know, whatever happened to get. We'd eat everything, eyes and all. But maybe the times they had fish, the fellas in the kitchen would eat all the fish they wanted, eh? Maybe save something themselves for a few days, who knows? We don't know. You know what was going on, you don't know. But I know they were fat. So, well, you can't blame them.
Yeah.
I don't care who it is. You work in the kitchen, if you have a chance to eat, you'll get it, eh? Good luck to them. But, I mean, it was spiritism that way. And,
was it a big camp? Were there a lot of men there?
Oh, yes. I don't know how many hundreds were in there. Quite a few. But I wasn't that first camp that went down. There was too many there. That's why they transferred us, you see. But that's why these guys got killed on account of it. I mean, the Japs wouldn't give us a chance to save them, you know. We could have saved them. And just before we got free, liberated, some of the boys, they found some alcohol or something. They thought it was a sake. And they drank that stuff, and they poisoned themselves, you know. Three died. You couldn't believe they were just moaning all night, you know, like with this alcohol burning them. It was the wood alcohol or something they had. I don't know what it was. You couldn't believe it. They died. I forget their names now.
What was morale? Did everybody from that one camp work on the same thing?
No.
Split up.
Champ Chapeau. But the second camp was all the same thing. First camp, they worked in the shipyards. And part of us worked for...
This is D5.
Yeah, Champ Chapeau. And the other section worked for the foundry. Shantatsu. Oh, it was a huge place. And then the foundry... I work on cocaine mixture. That's what they use to paint the molds, to put them in ovens, to keep them together, you know. Well, I used to mess that up for 2-3 days. I'd mix the water around the batches, you know.
And when I noticed in the foundry, like the moles, the big moles, 15 tons, some of them, you know, for ships. This was parts, mostly parts for ships, I guess they used them for, you know. And they used to fall apart. After they're dried, and they take them all to there, you know, and pile them in the foundry all over the place, you know, a building about half a mile long. And they start falling over, eh? Then they're trying to investigate what was causing it, and they never found it, you know. And I work in a clay mixture, mixing clay. Then I work also in a pit. There was a Jap there working with me. He worked for about 3 months. He used to give me a bit of tobacco. Real nice. Never had two words with him. And one day, just before the end of the war, a few days before the war ended, I was working in the pit with him that morning. And there was a kind of a window, the reflection of the sun come through. And I saw a shadow. So I lift my arm. You know, so I saw something coming, like a shadow. I lift my arm. You know what it was? His round shovel, you know, he was digging with, picking up the stuff, the steel. They were cleaning the steel out of this coal dust. And he hit me with the shovel, so he got me on the elbow, you know, on the funny bone. My arm stayed up, wouldn't even come down rapidly. And I looked at him and I told him, I said, there's no good job. I said, I thought you were a good one. I said, they're all the same. You know, and it was, what was it to him, eh? It, they're drilled right in there, since they're born, you know. War, you know. And they, when they get killed, they don't get killed, say, in action. They come home, they're not recognized. Their people don't want to see them. But if they get killed, they're heroes. You know, some of them didn't even drink their water. They died with their water tied beside them in the hills of Hong Kong. And some ripped themselves apart with hara-kiri knives, you know. It's just their, you know, that's what they're brought like. You know, they're taught that. I can't. You could, I mean, we wouldn't do a thing like that, but, they, you know, they do it. And a few Japs told me themselves that if they go home, they're not recognized. They're better off dead, you know. Mm-hmm. Oh, a lot of them were talking about it.
Was there any morale kept up in the camp at all?
Well, we're always going to be free. Yeah. Or one, Chiang Kai-shek is coming over the hill to help us. Oh, in Hong Kong, the first 8 months I was there, we're looking for Chiang Kai-shek over the hills every day. That's all we look is, I don't know why, one direction. I always look the same way anyway, looking for him. Well, the water was there, so I had to look the other way for the hills. Oh, yeah, he's going to be supposed to be here this afternoon, you know. Oh, I don't know, 1,000 troops. And we'd even tease the sentry, the guards, you know, Japanese guards. Oh, we'd tell them, you won't be there very long, point our fingers at them, you know. Half of them didn't even understand us. And we're doing trading with them, like rings for cigarettes and, you know. I learned the language quite a bit. I can speak quite a bit of Japanese. He just took a chance. The guy would say, well, I'll give you my ring. He'd tell you how many decks of cigarette he wants for it, you know. So I want 100 decks of cigarette. And if you make some cigarettes for yourself, good, eh? I'm risking my life to get the cigarette. So if you make a deal, if you got 120 decks, you get 20 decks is yours. But he won't give you none of his commission, none of his 100 decks, you know. If you get, he wants 100 decks for that ring and that's it. Okay. Take the ring and trying to make a deal. So you try for all you can get. Say if you start maybe 140 decks, 150 decks, the Jap would say no, or they point their rifle at you. You go and talk to a sentry, you know, close to the fence. Sometimes you get close to them and the rifle would come up, eh? Well, when the rifle would come up, you figure, well, that's it, I don't go any further. But lots of time, the officer was around and you didn't know yourself that he was around the officer. You know, he's still trying to make a deal, but the Jap knows that that officer is going around the beat, eh, to check him. And they're not supposed to make any deals with us. So one especially was really friendly with me. I made lots of deals with him, so I got kind of brave with him, eh? No matter what he did with his rifle, I ignored him. Oh, just one day you need to pull the trigger. And he told him. Oh, just one day you need to pull the trigger. And he told me, come and see me in the hospital, I'm sick with dysentery. He brought me a loaf of bread, all the inside taken off with brown sugar and all folded it up for me, and nicely. And I was really sick with dysentery, and he gave me that. Boy, was it good. And he told me, you know, he explained to me the day what happened a few days before when I went to the fence, you know. And this officer was wrong. He was forced to shoot me, but he kept on coming. So I apologized. And said, never mind apologizing. He would have been dead. He was a good friend of mine. He brought me a cigarette and I was sick. Anyway, like I said, I ended up, I had a big kit bag of cigarettes. So I got in partner with another fellow. We're friends, you know. If somebody's sick, you could buy some rice because you couldn't eat it. Then you give them cigarettes for it, if they were sick. And I never tried to buy anybody's rice that wasn't sick. But if they were sick, they didn't eat the rice, well, if he wants to sell it, you know, he gets cigarettes for it anyway. And later on, he can buy rice again with cigarettes. Same thing, if he doesn't smoke them. So we did that. A lot of guys, you know, if we had cigarettes, we did it. So, I ended up in the hospital. I got this full kit bag of cigarettes. And this joker that I got partnered, he's a friend, you see. He's got nothing, but he's my partner. He's trying to make deals. All he does is get fat, you know, with my cigarettes. I ended up in the hospital. I was in there for a while, sick, you know, with dysentery. I come out of the hospital, you know how many cigarettes I got left? None. He must have gained about 30 pounds. He got fat on my cigarettes. Boy, was I mad. He lives right down here. I won't even mention his name. I'm sure that's so mad at him. So, he's blind now. He might be interviewing him down here. No, I will. Freddie, he took a conference thing when he come back. Mm-hmm. He lives right over here. I mean, I'm nothing to be ashamed of. He done it to me. I'm so insulted. So I asked him why he done it all. He was hungry and I don't know. So I tried to deal again, but I didn't have much to work with, you know. Mm-hmm. So I did. Anyway, I ended up, even after I was prisoner in Japan, you know, when I worked in the foundry, we had all kinds of stuff in there. I went inside of a building with a honcho like a boss, and we're carrying stuff to the sand mill where we make this clay and we mix sand for the molds, you know, make molds. So I found a bunch of a big pile of bags, and there was one bag open. It looked like flour. It wasn't flour. What it was, I don't know. It looked like, you know, these red brick that you grind down, mm-hmm. like red powder. So I took some of that and I mixed it with water and a bit of clay, you know, ground clay, and made little cookies, and I used a hot piece of iron while I was working and squeezed the cookies in there, you know, dried them out, bake them like. Then I'd bring some to camp, tie them inside my clothes, you know, and I'd say to the guys, well, 10 cents when you get to Canada, you know, you owe me 10 cents, I'm selling cookies. And when you chew them, oh, I ate a lot of them myself. And when you chew them, you could feel the grit, you know. Oh, it must have been crushed rocks of some kind. And constipation, man. Some guys didn't go to bed for 21 days. Oh, yeah, you were full, but full of clay. You were cemented. Oh, my business was good. And everybody's trying to find out where I got the flour from. I won't tell them, but it's Japanese flour I got, you know. Oh, all kinds of guys are buying my cookies. Oh, I keeping records, you know.
They're all in your lodges.
I never tried to collect. Oh, it was pitiful. And honestly, this is true. I must say, I'd say about maybe 100 pounds of clay a month. Dried out. And I traded the shirt. There was a Japanese girl working there. I gave an army shirt for some curry powder, you know. So I put the curry powder. Me put around, she felt she didn't give me enough, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So one day she told me she'd meet me at the other end. Like, she met me behind one of the lavatories and she gave me a couple of pear apples. And she got caught, you know, giving them to me.
For the shirt.
And the Japanese beat her up. You know, they beat her up bad. And they beat me up and they beat her up. And I was tied up at the fence, you know, at the gate for 3 days.
For 2 days?
3 days. They tie you at the main gate, you know, where the camp is. And when the Japs go in and out, they slap you in the face, spit in your face, and you get nothing to eat. They tie you with a piece of wire behind your back to a pole stripped to the waist, slap you around, you know. And I don't know, it didn't stop us. Well, some didn't do that, but And there was a guy by the name of Jock. He used to start stealing. He was a big man. He was about 6'4". He was a Marine. And he starts stealing Japanese food, like lunches. Oh.
Guards' lunches?
A lot of workers. Yeah. I guess, they have a lot of workers, and I don't know how many hundreds. Maybe 1,000 men worked there, you know. So he got smart. I would have thought of that myself, but I didn't. But he's stealing these lunches, Japanese lunches. And I don't know how many he's stealing, but he's eating pretty good, eh? First thing we know, Jock, we call him Jock. Oh, real nice looking guy, big fella, blonde hair. He was an athlete all his life, because when he first came into town, he was a well-built man. So you know what he said to us? You guys don't know how to live on this Chinese rations. You know, Japanese rations. You guys don't know, I'm part Japanese, you know. He's gaining weight, and he's a big man. How can he gain weight? He must have gained 25, 35 pounds. So finally they caught him. So they tied him up in the foundry, and all the workers, they all went by him, you know. Slap him. Well, after the first few slaps, he gets all numb, you know, spit in his face and everything. And they tied him to the outside the camp, punishing, you know, like that's what they do. They tied him up for a few days, and then let him go again, and let him go back to work. And he was such a big man, he had to eat, you know. And he starts stealing again. Anyway, they tied it in by the ankle. He was tied for a week or so at that time. And to a pole and the circulation, you know. So gangrene set into his feet. Anyway, he died. And the one time he tried to hang himself in the lavatory. You know, we had outside lavatory, like with a septic tank, you know. They used to use that on the garden, you know. Spread that manure on the garden. They call that manure, but those manure is what they use there. Well, it was the camp where we were doing the garden ourselves, because that's where we're growing for them. They saved the top for us, we eat them, they eat the vegetables, you know. But when you were sick, that was your job to spread that stuff around, you know. Anyway, he's trying to hang himself in the lavatory, and he tied himself to the 2x4 over the door, let himself go, and he was too tall. He folded his knees and he hit the ground. I think he didn't want to get hung. He should have known how much to measure, eh? But a Japanese sentry caught him. So they tied him up again. Oh, he was tied up quite a few times. He finally died. They finished him. He was starving to death. You see, every time they tie you up like that, you don't get no food. Then. Yeah, poor Jock.
Was there any kind of routine in the camp? Would you get up at a certain time and be fed in the morning?
5 o'clock in the morning. They opened. There was two big doors. There was no floors. It was built like a big shed, you know.
Yeah. I wonder if you could maybe describe what it was like, the barracks.
Well, it's in the middle part, from here to that window, or even wider, was just mud, ground. And at the end, you know these doors that you slide on tracks? They had two big doors like that at each end. They'd open them wide open, morning and wintertime, just like here. We had no fire, only one row of wood, you know, the board, the building, all 2x4s, and just rafters. There was no ceiling, you know, just a peak. And the rafters and the rats just crawl over that and all over the place.
Was it a wooden roof?
Yeah, oh, shingles, like, yeah. You know, like ordinary shingles.
Yeah, it was just like a big shed then.
Big shed, one ply of wood. There was cracks, just, you could see daylight on the outside, and when it snowed, the storm would come in, eh? Yeah. And there was all little rooms. Well, the room was no wider than this room here. Yeah. And it was 16 men.
That's about, what, 20 feet or so?
Mm-hmm. No, that's not that big, this. What is this room about 20 feet? No, Maddie, eh?
That room's 16 feet.
Yeah,
long.
16, yeah. So, they had 16 men to a room. It was all little straw mats, you know? And you're all side by side, and they issued us two little tin blankets. One for under, one for on top. And they had us, that's the bottom room, and then the top room, the other floor, you know, it was still nothing there. There was not complete floor across. Mm-hmm. Just each side, and a straight ladder nailed it up to each side of the room to go up to the next floor. Every room had a ladder like this, just made out of 2x4, you know. And you climb up the bed like that, you know.
This is on top of the rafters?
No.
No, it isn't.
Well, it was the building was high, see?
Mm-hmm.
Built higher, like twice this height, the wall, and then the roof. The rafters were over that yet. And, you'd all sleep like in these little rooms. And they call you up at 5 o'clock in the morning. You have to go outside and have this tinko, they call.
Didn't he go outside for roll call?
Have what?
Tinkle. That's tinkle or roll call, you know.
Oh, tinkle, right.
Yeah. So you go outside, you line up, and you number off, you know, Ichi, Shini, Shigoroku, your numbers, you know. And when they call your number, like, I need you cool. I'm 323, that was my prisoner number. See, you had to answer, you see. Then you go back inside, you have breakfast. You line up and go outside and line up to pick up your food and go back inside and eat it, you know, a little. Whatever you had to eat, and you had no dishes, you know. We had 7 ounces of rice a day. And lots of time, if they fed us like vegetable tops and stuff like that, you didn't get no rice. And the day you got fish, the head of a fish or a meal, you got no rice, just the head of that fish or the tail, you know. Ordinary white fish or something like that.
Would you get this all at once?
The head?
No, the issue when you gave me the
fish. No.
3 times a day?
At the afternoon, we get issued at the foundry also rice. But for a while they made rice flour out of rice, you know, and they made us a loaf of bread, 16-ounce loaf of bread. Each man at 5 o'clock in the morning would get a loaf of bread, 16 ounces, that was supposed to last you the whole day. Breakfast, and you carry part of it for your lunch at work. We had to walk 3 miles to work, 3 miles back, and then you eat the rest of your loaf of bread at night for supper. Well, lots of time when they give us a loaf of bread in the morning, eat the whole thing. Then you had no dinner, no supper till next morning, 5 o'clock. And that's all you'd get. I don't know for how long. We were about 3-4 months like that. So we're getting. And then when they transferred us from Hong Kong to Japan, they did the same thing. They made 2 rice little buns. You get 2 little buns about this size for the day, you know. Like that was your dinner. You were in the bottom of the ship. They let you out twice a day out of that ship. Then they put down a few pails of water a day to drink, you know.
This is going from Hong Kong?
Yeah, and all we did is just touch our tongue with the water because there was not enough water for any of us, you know. And it's a wonder we didn't all die in the bottom of that shit because just the sweat just poured off. You were all close together and you never saw daylight. And that's where we live. And by the time we got to close to Japan, all them buns were molded there. Oh, it was terrific. And for a while they also fed us this barley. And the barley, well, you don't feed animals straight barley, you kill them, right? It's too strong. I'm telling you. You couldn't believe the gas pain. We'd just like heart attacks. We'd get so much gas in our system, we'd pass right out, you know, from this barley. And so this lieutenant in charge of the camp, this Marine, saw the Japanese officer, this Ancho, and told him, he said, we're going to lose all our men if you don't start giving us rice, you know. He said, our men are just going to, they're dying from this barley. You bloat right up, you know. So then they changed it again. They put us on this vegetable, like just the tops, carrot tops, no salt, just boil them like spinach and eat that. And also the second year I was in Japan, two of us, we went to talk to a military officer we had in the camp and asked him, there was a ration store in the camp where they get our rations from.
Military officer, no, this would be Canadian?
No, this Marine, he was a military officer in charge of us, medical. Okay. And we asked him if we could cook some rats. Well, he kind of laughed, you know. He said, they're poison, you know. You know they're poison. But he said, I'll tell you, he said, if you boil them for 3 or 4 hours, you'll boil the poison out of them. You don't have to worry. If you want, I won't advise you to do it, but if you want to eat them, eat them. So, me and my friend, well, we said we've got to catch our rats first, you know. So we found a little can. And we put at the foundry, you know, and we put a little piece of wood at one end, plugged the hole, and you know where the bottom part of the tin was, we cut it in four, folded that inside, tied a piece of string to it, and we put it under the ration store. Oh, the rats were big, they're just like cats, you know. So the rat, when we put some of our rice in there, the rat would go inside to eat, and when he was finished eating, he couldn't back out because the tin would go in there. So we killed 22. So I think we had 1 or 2 days off at Christmas. So we stole wood a little bit. We tie in our crust, you know, at the foundry, a couple pieces at a time, and we were gathering some wood for maybe 3 weeks, a month, I don't know, and hiding it in the camp. And I don't remember, I think we asked our officer if he'd ask the Jap permission, we could make little fires, you know, time we were off, and they they granted us that much anyway, so cook our rats. I think it was three of us that did that together. And you know, oh, it's terrible, it makes you sick when you think about it. We cooked the rats, and then we took the meat, eating it, you know. And you know the juice? Like, it's fatty. Well, we figure, that's protein, thanks. Hey, we figure we got protein, you know. We'll drink the juice. Hey, vitamins. Big ideas. Like, oh, we talk, we're like a bunch of kids. We're crazy ideas. Oh, we figure, we're drinking that juice, so I don't know we get sick, eh? Thanks. The next day we go to work. I'm not kidding you. We went to work, eh? I'm sick. Every 2 minutes we got to go to the laboratory. We got diarrhea. You couldn't believe we never had any meat of any kind for 2 years. Nothing. And drink this juice and that meat. And every time we go to the, we had to walk all the way through the building to there and the foundry to go. Oh, we're all cramped up. And by the time we get there, we come back, we have to go again. Eh? And every time we come back, the Japanese officer, Japanese civilian, you know, in charge of us. We're not doing any work. All we're doing is running to the laboratory, so he's beating us up steady. I think I went 21 times the next day.
It was because of the meat.
Well, sure, and the juice, that grease we drank. Yeah. We nearly died, the three of us. Oh, I think we were sick for 3-4 days. Weak? Oh, we couldn't walk. I weighed only about 117 pounds. I went in there, it was, what, 195 or 200, somewhere around there. So we never hit any more rats. But, I mean, we did then. They were good, just like chicken.
Did anyone else try eating that?
I don't know. I'm so busy with myself and treating it, I don't remember. And going to work, you see, we used to, if we find anything on the road, like it's the city, eh? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you Japanese orange peeling, see it on the ground. Well, there's guards along with us. We're lined up three wide, you know, going to work, marching down the road. And we jump on these peelings, see? Fight to get them, to eat them. No matter how many sentries around you, your guards, they hit us with rifle butts, you know, and everything. Still stop us, hey, we get a bump on our head, doesn't matter. We get killed for a piece of orange. And one night I found a head of a duck. It must have been a tame duck, I don't know. But we're walking along, and I spot this beak, you know. Maybe it was an ordinary duck from the field, I don't know. I never killed a duck in my life. So I see this, the neck was cut off, you know, just the head laying there. It looked to be fresh, you know. It couldn't have been there very long. Picked up the duck. Had a big fight in camp. 3 or 4 guys tried to get off me, but I wouldn't give it to them. They said they saw it first, you know how it is. Cigarette butts, we did the same thing, fight over that. I skinned it. So I made a little fire at the foundry there. I got caught there too. I made my fire to cook my duck, eh? The head. I had just about finished eating it anyway, I didn't care. But the Japs saw the fire where I made the fire at the foundry. Well, I didn't figure it was dangerous for fire, I don't know. Well, maybe just me, I don't know, I never asked. There was no thing where the thing could catch fire where I made the fire anyway. So I just finished eating my duck, I ate the bones and all, I guess, eyes, everything. She gave me good looking anyway, I was happy I had this bit of duck. Also, some other stuff we used to eat, right by the foundry, that little river, something like Saint River here. And you know a turnip, a biggie. Well, this was the same size, but they call that daikon. I don't know if you ever heard of a daikon. Well, it's like a turnip. It's long and white. And to my cousin, it was a turnip. I mean, we call them turnips here. They'd be, I guess, the bad ones, they pick them out, you know. It's the bruised one, they throw them in the water, eh? They'd be floating into this river, right by, through the foundry, you know, by the foundry. And we had a coffee break in the morning, 15 minutes, in the afternoon, 15 minutes. We didn't get no coffee, but we had a break. So I'd go by the river there and watch for these, well, we all did it, you know, if we had a chance, and watch for these daikons to go by. And we'd pick them up, some were swollen with water, eh? We'd take them inside, drop them on a piece of hot iron that was in the foundry, keep on working, watch, keep tab of it, you know, bake it like. And then we'd eat it. Hey, we'd run to the lavatory and eat it. But I'm telling you, some of them taste pretty rank, you know, because they were rotten with that water in them. Yeah. We'd eat them anyway. And that also would, oh, no wonder we got bad stomach ulcers and everything. Well, the things I ate everything I could find. Some ate snakes, I never did, but I never seen any snakes. Maybe I would have too. You know, but I mean, different part of Japan they were at, I guess. I never seen any snake, but I've heard of it, didn't you? They ate snakes. I don't know if we're the only three that ate rats, but I know we did. This is honest truth. And a lot of guys, they say, well, stories, you know. Tell you another thing I used to do in the foundry. My boss, I was pretty cute with them, you know. I wanted tobacco. Now and then some of the bosses are not too bad, you know, they give us a little pinch of tobacco and a kisiru. My boss gave me a little pipe. I worked hard. Well, I barely work hard and get beat up all the time. Still get beat up, but still don't get as much. So he gave me a kisiru, a little pipe. I still got it, eh? It's up there somewhere. Yeah, it's up there. Anyways, give me a little pinch of tobacco and I'd smoke my pipe, you know? Kept it for souvenir. And, it's what?
Couldn't this be what they smoke marijuana with?
Mm-hmm.
Or opium?
Oh, now, yeah. People around, yeah, they do. Well, anyway, that's the type of pipe they use. They call them kisiru, and their tobacco is kizami. So I say, Koshi Kizami, I'd sweep around his office. You know, he had a little desk behind the play mill there, and had a broken mirror on top of it. Just a little box with a little cover, you know, that you lift, put stuff in. It was hanging on a post, you know, behind the corner there. I called it his office. I mean, it was just a hole. Didn't even have a room. They had nothing. And a little bench with four legs to sit on. That's what he had. And they're very poor, you know, even their clothes all patched up. Everything they had on them, they had the same pants when I left there as when I got there. I was there over 3 years. All patched up. They patched themselves at work, you know, the workers. They really worked on people, you know. You couldn't believe. And you're never supposed to be sick. Never, never, never. They say it's an evil to be sick, you know.
Well, when you would get up in the morning, you'd go out for roll call.
Mm-hmm.
And you would get some food then when you went up for roll call?
After roll call, you come back into the barracks.
Into the barracks.
Yeah, you get dressed properly then. And then you line up for breakfast. And after breakfast, they had another roll call before you went to work.
Did somebody bring breakfast around to
you? No. And they lined up outside like a bunch of dogs in the cold and wait for your turn. Sometimes it took about half an hour or more.
Would you take a bowl with some food?
Not a bowl. Whatever you had to eat in.
Yeah, cans.
Can, anything. Yeah. Piece of wood. Anything you could carry your food on. But you could scrounge. And then you had another roll call after breakfast as you lined up to go to work. You had the number off again. And your number, you know. Niju, Nijuku. And then when you get to work, before they break us off, you know, to go to work, you had to number off again and see your number, you know. So you're not missing on the road, you know.
When you walk through the streets, how did the people come out of their houses and say anything to you at all?
Not really, no. Well, there was guards around us all the time. You see, there was always maybe 10 guards, sentries walk on each side of us, you know. Maybe every 50 yards or so, there was a sentry on one side, one another, here and there, you know. And two or three walk at the back, and some walk in the front. Well, no, the people didn't interfere with us, you know. And at the foundry after, say, for dinner, when you come for dinner, we had a mess hall like supposed to be for us.
Just for the prisoners?
Yeah. And you had to line up when you come out of the building, you know. And then you had to number off again. They call your number. And you go and have your dinner. After your dinner, the little bit of rice you had or whatever you had. You go back out. They call you back out. I think we had half an hour for lunch. And then you number off again and go back to work. And just before you leave the Sentatsu, like to come back to camp, you had to line up again for roll call. Go to camp, roll call again in camp, and go into your hut. And I forget what time it was, about 10 o'clock or so, there was another roll call before you went to sleep. You know, you're really tired, you want to lay down, you got to wait. If you did lay down, you had to get up for that roll call. And go back outside in the cold, you know. And I guess you know fire. I'll tell you how we used to sleep. One would, we matched two and two together, you know. One would sleep for a few hours, so you wouldn't freeze to death. You wake him up, and then he eats sleep. So we saved ourselves. Well, one boy died, right, the third one for me, in the camp, I think was Crusoe. He died, froze to death, right in the camp, laying there at night. His partner went to sleep and never woke up.
Was it Canadians that would be... Would the Canadians sort of stay together and the Americans stay
together? No.
Or was all...
No, no. All this time, all the time I was in Japan, in the camp I was in, there was only about 35 Canadians. That's all was there. All the rest was American. Mm. And D-15, I mean, D5, there was a lot of Canadians there too, but they stayed there. That the one working at Sentatsu. That's why we had such a rough time. I don't know. Well, and then we had some British too, you know. And the British and Canadians, they were treating fellow rough in this camp because, like, you know, they were all American Marines mostly. Where they come from, I don't know. And I'll tell you, I had a big grudge against some of them. And they, well, they couldn't treat us that bad, but if they had had their chance, they would have. But like a lot of things I've seen, and favoritism and the little favors that they could do between each other, they did it there only. You didn't have it. They tried, they acted like they didn't do it, but we knew they did, you know. Mm-hmm. We were pushed around a lot by our own men, you know, like they were American. There's a lot of chips on their shoulder, I don't know why.
Where were the camps in Japan? Did you happen to know their location?
Well, we had our... Well, it was... Well, we were not far. We were only 3 miles from the foundry. It was really where all the businesses were, you know. Our camp wasn't supposed to be there. As far as I know, National Law didn't recognize it. You know, camps shouldn't have been built there where they were because we're right in the firing range all the time. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't they bomb it right over us all the time because... Big foundries right there.
Tokyo?
Oh, how far it is from Tokyo, I'm not sure. Yeah. You know what I mean? I went through Tokyo.
Well, it was near a big city.
Well, it was a city.
Nagata
City, that's where I was in.
Isn't that big city?
No, Nagata. That's where I was. Well, they had the list of the cities that were going to bomb, you know, for the atomic bomb.
Yeah.
And we were the next one on the list. If that bomb wouldn't have stopped the war, we would have got it the next day. Well... When the Japs surrender, a fellow with a bomber come down, a small plane, you know. He was 21 years old, American pilot. He was a young fellow, like 21. And the officer called us out. He come into the camp, and the officer called us out. They said it was a man, a pilot, come down. The war was over, to come down. We're there for about 2 days already, not working. We didn't know what was going on, you know. And he come to let us know that the war was over. So we laughed at the officer. We're all laying around in the building. We never come out. So he had to come into the building to prove himself that he was there. Mm-hmm. So they took some kind of table he stood on, and he told us that the war was over. There'll be planes coming over to drop food to us and clothes and everything, and then everybody went haywire, eh? Jumping up the ladders and not even come up. That means the one and nobody broke their neck. They wouldn't even come on the ladders, just jumping up from the top where we were staying, you know. And then we all run outside, and I bet you it was not even an hour after he went away. You know, he took off of his plane. And the plane started coming with food. B-29, you know, dropping in parachutes. You could never believe it. And they had these small planes, bombers. They come over to the camp and just dive down at us and do the victory roll on top of the camp, inside the fence. After you understood, I bet you the planes were coming 3 feet from the ground. We're just flopping on the ground. You see, they're going to kill us. They're going to finish us, you know. Oh, they all went crazy. And they're dropping their pipes at us, dirty socks and notes and And you would laugh, you know. We had orders from the officer, like, anything you find outside the camp that drops on the parachute, the food, everything's going to be brought into the camp to be divided. Nobody can touch anything. Those are strict orders.
This is an American officer?
Yeah, there's one in charge of the camp, this Marine. So anyway, there were all kinds of parachute dropping all over the place outside the camp. Anyway, the war's over, eh? So the gates are open. We're running all over chasing these parachutes, the food coming down. Anyway, there's a case come off, wooden case, you know, and it broke when it hit the ground. You know, it was into these powerhouse chocolate bars, American bars, long bars, you know. Oh. So we each got a little cardboard box and we're supposed to gather everything. It's about 10 of us. Bring it back into the camp with one in the box, one eating, one in the box. And we got sick, eh? Start bringing up and diarrhea. Boy, we didn't know which way to go. And we made promise coming to the camp that we're not going to touch no more. You know, no more food. So another bunch, two big barrels got loose from a parachute, welded together. You know what was inside of it? Cocoa. Imagine when it got free from that parachute, the way it's coming down that barrel. It hit the ground, it bust open, eh? Cocoa, man, just like fog. All you could see them guys, the white of their eyes. They were all cocoa.
I'll tell you the truth, they thought it was a bomb that hit them, you know? They didn't know what it was. Another one, there was one coming down and they had these big gallon cans of peaches. And this this house wasn't far from the camp. Japanese woman. She come out of her house and she saw that big case coming down. I guess she was going to loot it and take it into her house. Instead of letting it hit the ground and pick up what she could after, no, she's underneath it. Eh? Her arms wide open, this case is coming down, we're watching her. Bang, there on the head. I bet she'd put her in the ground about 5 feet. Oh, did she go down? Oh yeah, I killed her. Squashed her to death. I don't know how many gallons there was, it's all in cans. They were piled up about 3-4 high, the cans in this crate. Oh, a big crate. About 6 feet long by five, you know. That must have been a lot of weight, eh? Maybe a couple ton. Oh, kill that old Japanese woman. Oh, different stuff like that, you know. And the parachutes, they were beautiful. Wonderful silk, you know. Oh, lots of fights over that. And anyway, when they took us, they were going to take us out of the camp, they took a bunch first, you know. And it was everything in the camp, lice and everything else, and sand fleas. And so taking these blankets out of the camp and selling them to civilians. Yens, you know. 500 yens a blanket. Oh, if you let that blanket go by itself, you'd walk away with the lice, you know. And the Japanese families were buying the blankets from us. I left the camp with 3,000 yen. Oh, yeah. Then I handed up one. We went to Oklahoma to the side, you know, waiting on the seashore there for about 2 days, waiting for our turn, you know. They got a kind of a medical center there. They're putting us through, you know, and they give us shots. And then they load you on these boats, you know, or planes, whatever come up first, you know. They were taking them across, you know. So I ended up in this hospital train. I went to Guam Island. I went to Guam Island for about 3 weeks. They give us blood. They give me blood transfusion. And right after that, they issued tickets for beer. You know, this was a military camp. And this nurse didn't know. I guess she just come on duty, and she's dishing out the patients all these tickets. So she gave me tickets for beer, too. And a friend of mine come along and he said, Tom, you got any tickets? I said, sure, he didn't know how to blood transfuse. He said, come on. I said, let's go. They had a little tent outside where they sell the beer. Well, they didn't sell it. They give the tickets. So we had 14 ticket seats. I'll never forget it. We used these hospital robe pajamas, you know. So we got 14 beers each. Never had no beer. We go behind this little tent and sit there and start opening these cans. You know, I didn't drink much, got sick right away, you know, with that blood transfusion, and it started raining. Oh, the rain is coming about that big. Just straight down, you know, this tropical country there, too. We got soaked and I'm sick. Went back to my bed, I laid there. Oh, I nearly died. I'm not kidding you, my chest was going like this. I know, my old heart started really pounding. And then this nurse, oh, she really got bailed off for giving the tickets. Well, she didn't know, I guess. It was my fault. And the next day she came over to my bed, she was crying, apologizing, you know, it was her fault. I mean, I was over it, I guess, but I was scared to die.
After all you've been through.
Yeah. Hey, you know, one that died out just outside Honolulu, on the ship. I forgot what he did do, but he died on the ship. Carelessness. And you know, we got on them ships, they never stopped us from eating. We lined up for breakfast, and you know, after you got your breakfast, we go to the end of the line, wait for your turn again. Anyway, the first morning, it was noon, the old cook climbed on top of the deck. He called the men in charge of the ship there. He said, I forgot what he called them, captain or something. He said, Captain, he said, when is dinner? He said, it's 12:20. He said, we're still serving breakfast. He said, and the line's bigger than ever. It was. So, that poor cook. So they decided, and they were all sitting all over the place and on the ship. Couldn't even lay down. You'd die. We're all bloated like this, you know, about 3-4 meals apiece already in our stomach. And we're waiting for dinner. Sick. So they decided the next day they're going to issue tickets. I think it was around supper time. The man in charge of the ship said, he said, now, he said, without a ticket, you can have no food tomorrow. So you got to have an issue, a ticket issue. Wait for your issue. It was a little piece of cardboard, red. No, never forget about this. Why? At breakfast time, we all got one, so we got no second breakfast. So some smart clown on the ship, who it is, I don't know,
found the recipe of these cards, and the cardboard they had, he's selling them. Well, all the Americans had their money. We had no money. But American guys are buying tickets, see? Oh. Dinner comes along. We line up again. Start eating. I bet you it was 6 o'clock, we're still serving dinner. Oh, cook, he's going to give up. He said, if I know I wouldn't drown, I'd jump off the ship. He yelled at the captain. So the captain, well, he says, I don't know what's happening. He said, we got tickets, you know. Well, he said, I don't know. So something is wrong. Oh, and he couldn't stop it. All the way down. I wouldn't want to have been the cook on that ship. He must have went crazy. All the way down on the ship. And anyway, they opened the canteen. An hour in the afternoon, an hour in the morning. You're allowed to buy chocolate bars and Coke. Gallon Coke. Cans, you know. And they I don't know. So I guess they got so much ration on the ship, they just let go so much a day. There's about 13 or 14 gallons a day dished out in Coke. Well, the first 14 guys buy the 14 gallons. Pardon me. But us, we couldn't do nothing. Like I said, we had no money. We wouldn't even try to get in the lineup. But them guys, and see the chocolate bars, so many boxes a day issued. Well, instead of buying one or two bars, eh? First few guys that get there buy a full box. And don't give nothing to nobody. They're all a bunch of pigs, as far as I'm concerned. But they were. They were. So, I forgot I got some money. I got some money. Oh, yes. I got, I sold a guy for a few American dollars. And there was card games, you know, on the ship. Oh, you couldn't believe those pile of money like that on some of the tables. And the guy rolling the dice would hire somebody to pick up the money, you know. Some of them soldiers lost their total prisoner of war pay on the ship. They shouldn't have given them their money. All the Americans, you know, some of them guys, they come off the ship with not 1 cent. And there was a young sailor who was on there. He was supposed to go home on leave, you know, off the ship. And he gambled. He made quite a bit of money. And he was sleeping on, like, his trousers under his head. And we going to land up in San Francisco that next morning. And when he woke up, all his money was gone. You know? And he saved, he was a long time at sea or something. And he saved all kinds of money. And I forgot what he was going to do. His mother was all a widow or something. He had quite a few kids, sisters and brothers. And the money he made, he was going to dish it out between his brothers and his mother. You know? Couldn't even go on leave. And he even went mental on the ship, the kid that day. I'll never forget him. Nice kid, you know. I bet you I've seen him cry 4 hours straight in the afternoon, sitting on the deck there, you know, crying. Cruel. And you know, when we landed in San Francisco, they let people come on the ship, you know, like women dressed in bathing suit with bottles of whiskey and all that. You know what we went for? Chocolate bars. You know, they gave us a bottle of whiskey, we threw it overboard. We wouldn't drink it. We wanted chocolate bars, sweet. We had no sugar. We couldn't believe it that we went for sugar. Oh, chocolate bars. Boy, I ate chocolate, it'd come out of my ears. And I laughed there too. When they loaded us on another ship to go to Fort McDowell, got down there and you're supposed to be at your best behavior, you know. They told us there's a Japanese regiment there. It's an American-Japanese regiment. But you fellas have to realize that they are Americans. They're not, you know, actual Japanese. We got to see that. Hey, we want to see that. We can't believe it. How could they have a Japanese regiment here? Well, when in our own mind, we're all crazy over this. We want to run across these guys. So we got down there, and they were really nice to us. You couldn't believe what they did for us, Americans, in every way down there, you know. Anyway, everything is free to us in the garrison. Oh, it's a big garrison there, Fort McDowell. I don't know how many. There are thousands and thousands of troops there. So, I spot one in the canteen. That night, the beer was free to all of us. And they had the girls, the quacks, you know, the wrens and all that in there dancing. They were supposed to be, well, they were our, what'd you say that?
Hostess.
And we're dancing with them and everything, and that free beer. So I saw a few Japs there, and I heard there was some in the bowling alley. So two of my friends said, let's go to this bowling alley. So we go to the bowling alley, and there's one, he's playing a ukulele, you know, singing with a cigar. He had a cigar in his mouth, kind of humming, and there's two sitting beside him, kind of fat, round head, you know. So I said to him, I said, take the cigar out of your mouth, take the grin off your face, you know. I'm feeling good. It didn't take much beer because I didn't drink. So he's just kind of smiling with a cigar in his mouth, and he's, don't take it out, you know. I guess you don't think I'm serious. Didn't take long, the MP picked us up, eh? Took us back to the, well, they told us we were in jail. We're not in jail. They took us back to the building where we're staying. We're not allowed to go out. They're guarding us, the three of us. So we're supposed to go on charge. I think the next afternoon, about 2 o'clock, a sergeant come in there, Marine sergeant. Oh, they were really, they're a strict deal at Marine business, and they're really proud of their services. And comes along with his red cap and peeked right down. And said, okay, come on, you're Canadians, you know. So we got up, we followed him, he took us in front of this officer. So he's gonna, he reads the charge, you know. Why did we do it and this and that? I apologize, a few drinks, you know. Saw the Jap was enough for me. Well, he said, you know, he said, like you were explaining, that these are American. No, they're not real Japs. So we will, the three of us at the same time, we all turn around, Jap is Jap in every sense. If it's Jap, it's a Jap, and that's all there is to it. We said, no, he said, they're different. They're born here. They don't even speak their language. Well, I said, that's not our fault. It's still Japanese. Well, he said, okay, he said, I'll tell you something, he said, and I'm supposed to punish you guys. He said, but if you want to promise me you'll never interfere with another Jap on this garrison, he said, we're worried. We're scared. We're a bunch of us there, you know. And he said, the Japanese regiment is so scared they don't know what to do. They're scared to walk down the sidewalk in there, you know. They're so scared all you Canadians are going to kill them. Well, I said, maybe they will, I don't know. Well, he said, you guys promise that you won't touch any more, any of them. So we promised them. Then I don't know, we got it. We're looking for them though. Mm-hmm. Just to, we can't believe that they're good people, you know. We're sitting there watching them, and even in the canteen or anywhere, we'll just watch them, see what they'll do, you know. We figure they're just as sneaky as the others. Because you couldn't trust them. You couldn't turn your back to a Jap. They'd do something wrong to you. And I was hurt, like, I was hurt also bad in the foundry. I was beat up, you know, by Japanese. I was a long time in bed. This is a judo expert. I fought with him. I fought back. You know, the last year I was in Japan, I wouldn't work. I made a promise in the Japanese face that I never would do any work in Japan again. I never did. I went to work, but I didn't work. And the little kids would come in the oven, I'd chase them away. I'd just say boo, you know. You know, if you fight for yourself, they respect you. Stick for your own, you know. Well, I figured they would kill me anyway. No, sir, well, they treat you like a gentleman after. They know you're going to fight back, you know. Well, they had their rights. They could have, but they didn't. I figured they would.
You said that you stopped work for a couple days before the plane came over.
Yeah.
Did you know that the war was over then? Were you getting any information from outside at all?
No, we didn't know. We didn't know. Well, we figured the Japs are all gone, the guards.
Wait, did you just wake up and they were gone?
Yeah, there was nobody around. And there was nobody going to work. So we figured the war's over. But yet, we don't know what's going on. And then that plane come down. And that's when we actually found out, honestly. We didn't know. The war was over a few days already when we found out. We couldn't believe it. And then they marched us out of there. Well, the bomb just dropped a few days before, you know. And
did you know anything about that? Did you hear it at all or see anything?
I was only 80 miles from it. 80 miles from the bomb.
Did you
we didn't know what it was.
Did you hear it go off?
Oh, yeah, I don't know. To my concern, it was an earthquake or something, you know? Because I went through a couple of earthquakes in Jamaica. We didn't know what it was. It happened, you know, through the night. But, I mean, I don't know. I still say we were affected by it, you know. That.
You've been going on for 2.5 hours. You're supposed to phone Stern.
Hey, you got too much for me there.
No.
Oh, I could tell you a lot of stories. Well, I had a writing on the paper here. She got it somewhere. When I come back, the fight I had in Japan, fought back. Shoot his face. No resistance, you know. Well, I was black and blue. I was about 3 weeks in camp. Then I wouldn't work after that. He hit me with a piece of stick for his ear, you know. I was carrying with another guy a piece of steel, and it kind of burned. I made a face,
And then he started throwing me around. He beat up the... He killed a few guys already, that guy. He was a Jude expert, you know, in the front. And,
this is a guard?
Yeah. No, this is a worker. He was a Judo expert. A Japanese Judo. And, when I made a face, he jumped me. He threw me like an overarm throw over him. So I started fighting back, eh? Knocked the wind out of me, tried to kick my head in, you know, with his feet, but I had enough sense to keep my ass off the ground. But he had these running shoes like they were, you know. And I couldn't fight no more, I bit him. I chewed his face. I'm not kidding you, I chewed his ears. I had no resistance. And then he ordered a big mole to drop over me. And I was on the ground and I rolled, you know. And the mole dropped. He went one way, I went the other. We met and that was it. He just looked at me, I looked at him. And I think I passed out. They took me to camp. And it was a long time in camp. It was all bruised, you know. Then I went back to work and I never worked. I never worked for the job. I wouldn't do nothing. I went to work. I was at work. I wasn't working. No, sir. I told him to kill me. Well, that's stubborn, I think. I don't, and you know, right now, at my age, I couldn't do that now. I wouldn't have the nerve to do it. But young and stupid, that's all it is. Boy, was I had a grudge against some people. You know, I wanted to go, after the war, I wanted to go in the RCMP and go to Vancouver. I wanted the RCMP barracks, you know. I thought if I could join the RCMP and I know the language and, you know, they had a lot of Japanese people at the coast, and I'd like to work like on the docks, you know, as a policeman. So this officer, yeah, I guess he had a big kick out of me. I was all dressed up when I went to see him. And he said, what makes you think you'd like to work over there? Well, I said, you know, it'd be kind of nice, you know. I speak the language and all that. But he said, how would you be with them? I said, maybe I'd get even with a few of them. Well, that's a bad word. Maybe I'd get even with a few of them. Well, that's a bad word when I said that, you know. I think he was interested before that a bit, you know. No, I told him I had good training. No, I said it better not. So after a while, I joined the... What do you call that regiment I was with here? Really? No.
I forgot. Engineers.
Engineers. I went into the engineers here. What I'm telling you.
Is this Army Engineers?
Yeah. What if they... militia. I joined the militia. I wanted to be in something. I liked the service, you know. They wouldn't keep me after the war because it was a long time in the hospital. I was a long time in the wheelchair in bed here in Winnipeg. So when I got out after the war, I joined the engineers. I joined the engineers, kind of lied a little bit, you know, so they got me in there. So when come time for my medical,
records came from Ottawa.
Yeah, records come from Ottawa. They offered me a coffin. The report. The colonel called me in, the colonel, the engineer. He said, you couldn't believe it. I said, why? He said, we were strictly ordered to discharge you. But he said, you're a good soldier. We'll try and keep you. Oh, so how are you going to do that? You know? Well, he said, I'll tell you. He said, we won't tell you, we'll tell them we'll discharge you or nothing. He said, I'm going to write back Ottawa and talk to them, you know, that you're a good soldier and you know your military stuff. And I went to Charlotte for a couple of weeks on the demolition schemes, you know, like we're blowing steel and all that, you know. I was pretty good at that. And so he said, I want to mind here. Anyway, he said, stay for another month. He said, I'll fight with them, trying to keep you. I said, okay. So I went to Charlotte. 2-3 weeks there. Or was it only 1 week?
Hold on. You're talking about after war, that thing's still running.
Oh, that's
a year.
That's okay.
So I went down there and had all that with them, you know, setting these craters. It was really interesting. I enjoyed it. Then we come back here and I'm training, you know. Boy, did I end up to be a sergeant? Yes, I was... they were going to make me a sergeant. You remember the sergeant's mess? The night before they discharged me, they, you know, they got a fun in the mess, sergeant's mess. So I was invited to the mess that Saturday night, and I went down there, and they had a, they collected money, you know, from the mess, like the sergeants, mm-hmm. all together. And they gave me $65, I think it was, yeah. Oh. Kind of nice, and they told me to come back and see them, you know. And you know what the Ottawa told them? If my ulcers didn't show for a full year, you know, that I was, like the hospital would say, I was clear for a full year that I could come back. And they let me get back in, you know. They told, they promised that to that colonel. He said, make sure, he said, if your ulcers don't show up for a year, come back. I was brokenhearted. I remember I come back home. I was all excited. I got feeling pretty good in the mess, and I come home with $65. But I got to know the guys, you know, and they were nice to me. I think because I was in Hong Kong too, you know, all the sergeants were really good to me. And I was acting sergeant. I felt pretty good about myself. You know. I never went back once, eh? And they begged me to come back, you know. I never went back.
Can I ask how you feel about the treatment you received since you came back from the government and pensions and things like that?
Well, right now I'm well.
Medical treatment and things?
I'm well treated right now. But I'll tell you,
For the first 5 years when he was back,
really
it was awful.
What
it was
did
worse
I
than awful.
10% I was getting?
You were getting no percent at all.
No percent at all.
For a long time, but...
And I was in hospital. My wife met me in the hospital. I introduced him in the hospital. We never went out together. Will you come visit me for about a year? Pretty near. I was a bed patient in a wheelchair for a long time in the Geological Hospital. I couldn't walk, bad feet, you know. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I come out of there. We got married after I come out, when I was on leave, eh? And you know what? She was supposed to keep on working. That was how we were going to get married.
Well, they told me he would never live. And 2 years was the absolute top length of time
that
he could possibly live.
I didn't know that.
But yet, you know, they let him out of that hospital with nothing.
Nothing. I had the pension while I was in there.
He had no stomach pension. He didn't get a pension for his stomach until...
So you would have to be paying for a lot of...
No.
No,
while I was in the hospital,
for
I was discharged.
Yeah, you were discharged,
I was getting $20 a month for cigarette money.
He was in, I would say,
I was in full pension.
Eight.
Maddie, I was in full pension while I was sick. If you're sick, they give you full pension in hospital. Remember?
You know, he's getting $260 and $260.40 a month. Now,
I don't even need it, you can't see me, right?
That he is 95% better physically than
95%,
he was at
honest.
That time.
I couldn't walk from here to that
he
car.
He couldn't eat, he never slept. We used to change the bed 3 times a night, the sheets for the sweats, the crying in the night for no reason, dreams.
Nightmares.
You know?
Yeah.
Nightmares.
Nerves.
Yeah.
And I was crippled. I couldn't use, it's one arm I couldn't use.
Yeah, couldn't,
I couldn't use at all. I couldn't even lift a water glass. And I was getting no pension whatsoever. And we applied for welfare even after we're married. Eh?
Yeah, and didn't get that either.
And we didn't, you know, they were going to, and they gave me, what is it? I had a pension when I applied for welfare, a little pension.
$22, I believe.
Yeah, $22 a month. And I landed, and I was 6 months in the hospital that time. She was at home with the baby. Little house, a wartime house, see?
But you know what? It's not the government's fault.
No.
The government really has done everything they could, but they really didn't know how to handle this.
No.
Yeah. It was a complete new thing.
And I've never been.
And from the story you've got on there, you must realize that I guess a lot that happened to them, they did to themselves with what they ate and how they ate.
Well, what I mean is...
they didn't know how to
cope with it. When you're hungry, you're hungry.
Yeah.
You'd eat anything. I'd eat a piece of wood if I figured I could chew it. When we first come out of prison camp, when they got on the ship, they should have controlled the food for us. I think that was the biggest mistake ever done on that ship. They just let us loose like a bunch of cattle in the big field. Just imagine, even you take a calf, never had nothing to eat, hardly, for 2-3 years. He's a year, 3 years old. And you put him in a big pasture of green grass, what's going to happen to that calf? He's dead. Eh? He's going to eat himself to death. And we did the same thing. It's a wonder they never stopped it right away. They never did. They started taking care of us, our food,
in hospital. Well, that's no time to try it, is it? Oh, let's stomach a stretch. I bet you some of us was bust open from the food. Hey, I'll tell you the honest truth. You'll never die from eating because we tried it. You can't eat steady. It's going to come out one way or the other. It's got to come out of you, but you'll be sick, but you won't die. Because I bet you, well, some days I had 10 meals. I kept on eating. You know these big 1 pound can of nuts? I don't know, I got that on this ship. The Ozark. I got this big can of nuts. I went with my mattress. I never got seasick on the ocean. I loved it, you know. I went right in the front of the ship, with dipped, you know, about 75 feet up and down in the storm. So I'm laying there with my mattress in the wind. I got that big can of nuts. So it's rocking too much, so I'm upsetting all the time. So I figure I'll lean against the ship in the corner, in the peak there, with my can of nuts between my legs. I'm going to eat nuts. I ate that old can of nuts. I think I ate all night. I got up, one for breakfast. Come back for breakfast, I'll end up again for another breakfast. And then I went and sit again in the same corner there. But by that time, my stomach was way out here. No kidding, it was way out here. I'm leaning against the ship, trying to take deep breaths, you know. I couldn't breathe, too full. There was no grunt. Oh, if I lay down, I'd die. Well, anyway, I figured if that didn't kill me, nothing will. I ate it all. And chocolate bars. You know, at the Work Point Hospital, when they were feeding me there 8 quarts of milk a day, I thought I was getting no food at all. And I gained weight on it. I was about 3 weeks on milk, and I gained weight. I must have gained about 7-8 pounds. And then after that, I bet you, the shots, needles they give us, you know, vitamin needles and vitamin pills, I don't know how many a day we get pills. I was averaging about 1 pound a day. I went up over 200 pounds. Hey, was I fat, eh?
205 pounds.
I got pictures. I'm telling you, I went up like a balloon. From 117, I went up to 205 pounds. Oh, I was fat. But that's not healthy, you know. They shouldn't have never done that to us, as far as I'm concerned. And all these vitamin pills did to us, and this thymine needle, these shots they give us every day, it made you starve. You could eat a meal and just like it disappeared. You could eat all day, never get full. Hungry all the time.
Oh, like I said, they learned from this. I mean, if they...
Yeah, doctors told
me. The Americans
me,
will know
doctors.
How to treat these Vietnamese prisoners if they ever do get them back, because they're going through the same...
They had me in the hospital, in Deer Lodge Hospital, how many times? 3 times dying? In cubicles?
How many times?
Yeah. In cubicles. And, you know, they come around the doctors and they talk to the nurse in the room, like, who talks off because poor bugger's dying. You're gonna be. So anyway, they were in this room one day, two nurses and a couple of doctors. They're all at the end of my bed talking together, you know. I was dying. I was the yellow mark beside my name. So finally, I got fed up with them, you know. They were talking there about half an hour together about me. But I'm not, because I'm dying, I'm not supposed to hear them, I suppose. So finally I yell at him. I said, "You're stupid." So one doctor looked at me. I thought he was on. He must have thought I was unconscious. I don't know. He said, "What do you mean I'm stupid?" I said, "You're stupid. That's 3 weeks from now I'm going to walk out of here." He said, "You what?" I said, 3 weeks from now I'm going to walk out of this hospital. He said, "I don't think so." He said, "Good luck if you can." I guess he's laughing at me. I don't know. He don't even feel sorry for me. I said, "Mark my word." I even pointed my finger at him. I don't think I could even lift my finger, but I did. I showed my finger. You know, 3 weeks to that day, I was walking out of the Deer Lodge. I didn't walk out, but I was in my wheelchair. I ran away. I went as far as a mall hotel in a wheelchair. Went
from
for a beer.
Deer Lodge, if you know where Deer
I went
Lodge
for a beer.
Was,
I was a dying patient.
He was like a juvenile delinquent.
Oh, yeah.
Couldn't keep him in the hospital, couldn't get mad. They didn't fight a bunch of wild Indians.
Hey, you know, they had detention downstairs in Deer Lodge, you know? I used to call that place Deer Lodge Hotel. I was in there for about a year. Well, over a year, I don't know. 58 months altogether I've spent there since I've been back altogether.
At least
58 months. It's a long time. Anyway, I take off out of there. At the time, I could walk. And all go and drink and come back, and it was scaring me. The orderlies were scaring me. So the matron would be waiting for me, eh? It's after midnight. So they'd all be lined up at the door, waiting for me. They'd lead me downstairs. They'd open the door, and they would, in case I start a riot, you know, they'd follow me down to this little room, this little jail. They had a mattress on the floor and a little bowl of water. I don't remember that place because I never seen the place. I'd wake up in the morning, they let me out, eh? I had a good sleep. I said, thanks for the good bed.
And you got Paul Stern.
Oh, yeah, I know.
You've got the Paul Stern.
I know.
Well, then do it.
I will. They're open till 3 in the morning.
Doesn't matter. You've got to let Don know whether you can be poked out.
I know. Okay. Well, I guess you got enough baloney for me.
Well, it's really been fine. It's really been nice talking to
you. Well, if everybody took as long as you.
Well, I was just talking, I mean, that's all.
I mean, you've said you've talked a lot about the camp and a lot of things, personal things that happened to you.
Well, lots of things I don't think of right now, but, you know, it's quite a bit I could tell you. I mean, a lot of it, even myself, I wouldn't beat up a dog, they would beat up. As far as lickings, I didn't talk too much about that because even today it's a dream.
Mm.
You know, you think of it yourself, you say, how can you express yourself to other people what you saw? Because my own little dog that I got here, I never beat them up the way they kicked us around. I'll tell you, we miss a meal in the camp if we didn't get a lick in a day. You miss a meal, as far as you were concerned. You had to get beat up. And you know, they wake you up to go to work in the morning. They come around and ask you if you're sick, the sergeant, Japanese sergeant, asks you if you're sick. He said, be okay, you're sick, eh? Then what do you do? Kick you in the stomach, Shikoto, go to work. Japan, nobody's sick. It's evilness. Fight evilness, work. And even the Japanese people, if they're sick, they work. I've seen some of the Japanese right in the foundry working, falling over, sick. I've seen pass out 2 and 3 times a day. And you know the one that were too sick to walk to work? They put them in a little cart, drag them to work. Two of the prisoners pull them to work, they sit them on a little bench and break bricks, you know, with a hammer. And I've seen some drop dead right off the bench with dysentery. Maybe going to the laboratory, passing about 18, 20 times a day. Some lose maybe 10, 15 pounds a day, you know, with dysentery, and die right on at work. Just keel right over, boy.